Hello everyone, and welcome to episode 54 of Connectivity. I'm Scott Thompson. This week we've got two segments and one bonus segment for you. And kicking things off, Josh sits down with Andy and Alex to talk about Pokemon Black and White 2. After that, myself, Neil, and Patrick talk about all the recent 3DS news, as well as games we've been playing, such as Resident Evil 6, Mists of Pandaria, and Hell Yeah. After the outro, there's another Doctor Who bonus segment where we talk about the mid-season finale, and I will warn you now, there are spoilers, within the first 10 seconds, so if you don't want to be spoiled, don't listen. Okay, enjoy.
Hello there, this is Josh Max, and with me today is Alex Calafi.
Hello there.
And Andy Gergen.
What's going on, guys?
And you two guys got your hands on Pokemon Black 2 and Pokemon White 2 this week before it came out. So I think what I have to do as a, self-proclaimed Pokey fanatic, I gotta ask you guys about it. First of all, Alex, favorite Pokemon, go.
Slaking, and here's why. It is, without a doubt, minus Regigigas, who doesn't count, the strongest Pokemon out there. And if you can get a combo going with Cofagarius, he's totally unstoppable in the competitive game. Right, Andy?
Yeah.
Andy's favorite Pokemon?
Captain Olimar?
Was accepting that or Agumon, so...
You said Pokemon, not Pikmin. Sorry, I got confused. I would say Jigglypuff, only because the sound he makes when he dies in Smash Brothers is unbeatable.
I don't know, I like the Pikachu Pika thing when it dies.
It's pretty spectacular.
Right?
I think it's because Jigglypuff has so many syllables, so when he screams his own name flying off the screen, it's pleasantly awkward.
It's prolonged.
It's prolonged.
Alright, so now on to the meat and potatoes of this chat we're gonna have. First, Andy, I want to know, this is your first Pokemon game since, I think, the original generation, right?
This is my first Pokemon game, more or less, period. I did drop about 3 to 4 hours into Pearl, and I put it back down something like, I think maybe I got one gym badge. I don't really remember getting a gym badge, but I probably did, because I got to a section in the second area where you had to go underground and go mining, and I got done with it, so I put it into the pile of games that don't get played anymore. So this is my first attempt trying to actually power through and play more of the game and genuinely try to understand what it is that makes this series such a phenomenon.
And how many hours did you put into this?
I'm sitting at 6.5 right now, I think. So I'm not super far into the game. Haven't had a chance to play it since the weekend, so I'm sitting at a 4-day gap right now, which is way longer than I would like. I kind of got to a spot where I don't know what to do, so I am resorting to reading FAQs, which are available because the game's been available out in Japan for months. So luckily there are FAQs, and I think I should be able to break through that barrier, because I actually got through to where I'm at fairly quickly, and I've been wandering around for about an hour. So it's about time I moved on.
Have you been enjoying it?
Yeah, I have been enjoying it. There are things about it that are a bit awkward, I think. Mainly that it's an RPG with essentially, at this point, no story. I'm sure that changes later on, but it just feels like the only story in this game 6 hours in is, holy crap, have you seen Pokemon? These things are amazing. But that's fine. I mean,
on that note, Alex, I've read your review. I'm sure people listening to this have read your review. You kind of talked about how the story wasn't exactly a highlight of the game. And as I also now know that you're also a Poke fanatic. So tell me, what was your experience with the game? Since you've played all of them and now you've played, the first direct sequel.
Okay. So Andy's about maybe 10-ish days since he's gotten the game, and he's 2 badges in. So, which is fine based on his experience and all that. Now, because of my pokey fanaticism, I got the game on Monday last week, and I beat it on Wednesday with 25 hours logged.
I had that kind of experience with Skyward Sword, for what it's worth.
Oh, well, God, that's, yeah, yeah.
It's nice to have those games, but...
No, yeah, I totally agree.
With that said, if you read my review, I was a little bit down on the game in some respects, because I actually really liked the story in Black and White. I thought it was the best story that a Pokemon game's ever had, by far. And I was interested in seeing how they picked it up. And...
Whoa, 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 hold on. Are you saying that capturing a legendary Pokemon and creating your own galaxy isn't a great storyline? Because, I don't know, I'd kind of like my own galaxy. Well, especially after I catch God.
Here's why the story in Black and White is better, though this is probably a tangent of some sorts. In previous Pokemon games, and actually in this Pokemon game, there is almost no story for the first 4 to 5 badges, and then it slops all of it on at once. Where, in the original Black and White, it actually sort of gave you an even progression throughout, which is what I really liked. And everything was coherent, and everything actually had several layers to it, instead of, I'm catching Pokemon, this Pokemon is the new powerful one, this is the new bad guy, and that's it. So
I will say that so far in my experience with version 2, is it called version 2 in North America? I don't think
so. It's technically called version 2, but we just call it Black 2 and White 2.
Or if you're lazy like me, you say Black and White 2.
Right.
What I found so far is that it seems, and maybe this is just my knowledge coming through a little bit because I'm very much aware of the legacy of the series, but it very much seems like this is a layered effort. Like, it feels like there is a very solid core game underneath, but every 20 to 30 minutes, my character is, like, introduced to a new thing, which is probably a new thing from, like, Fire Red that they're just giving to me now. But it just seems like here's a new thing, and maybe it's a new thing to this game, maybe it's not, I don't know. But it feels like this is the longest tutorial that I've ever played. Because there's always, they're just continually throwing new things at you, and at this point, like, between all the HMs and TMs and items and different types of medicine. And I saw at the shop in the Pokemon Center that there's, like, envelopes I can buy, and I have no idea what that does. Probably something with the online component of the game, which I haven't even gotten to yet. It just seems like there's so much to do in this game that I haven't had a chance to really absorb it all. Like, I know there's a lot of complexity in the way Pokemon fight each other with the different types, and I haven't really found enough Pokemon to take advantage of that yet. Like, I'm still just hitting with the hardest attack I've got right now with the highest level Pokemon I've got.
Is it Tackle?
Yeah, I think so. Although I've also got Tail Whip, I think, or something like that. Or
yeah!
Leaf Whip or something to that effect. Yeah, some kind of whip. And I've been kind of fighting, and Alex and I were actually talking in email about this, about whether or not I want to try to, like, level up multiple Pokemon at the same time or just focus on one for now until I know that I need more later. So I've been kind of balancing that back and forth. I'm kind of going back towards trying to level up more than one now that I've gotten one evolved. Also, I know that there's, like, benefits and drawbacks to evolving or not evolving when you're presented with the option. So there's just so much stuff here, and I like it, but it is really overwhelming to someone who's just playing for the first time. That said, they do talk a lot. They tell you what's going on. It's not like I can't read what's going on. It's just they just throw a lot of information at you, and they don't give you really a lot of time to absorb the information. And on top of that, it's at the expense of the story because, like Alex said, like I'm 2 badges in, and you don't get really a lot of the story until later on in the game. And so it just seems kind of pieced together. And I expect the pieces will converge later, and that'll probably be evident in the review that I end up writing. But so far, it does seem like a lot of things thrown together without a lot of cohesion. I just got past the part where you become a movie star, I guess. There's a part of the game where you go into a movie studio, and it's kind of like a puzzle game. Like, basically, you're given a predetermined Pokemon, and you have to win the battle in a specific way to match the script so that you get a lot of box office gross. And it just seems so odd. Like, it doesn't fit into anything that I've done until now. It's just sort of this weird little thing that I've stumbled across. Kind of like maybe like the fishing pond in a Zelda game where you don't do anything like that until you get there. And it doesn't seem to have any real bearing on anything else in the game. It's just sort of this fun little diversion. But it seems like it's a big part of the game, and I can't – obviously, I don't know how big of a part of the game it is because I haven't gotten that far past it yet, but it's so weird.
Well, here's the thing, though. I've only seen, like, 2 screenshots of this. I've been trying really hard to be spoiler-free for this game, and even though I've read about, you know, that part of the game, what you just said got me so excited I started to move around a little.
Oh, I don't get me wrong. I think if you understand Pokemon battling a lot more than I do, it's probably a lot of fun. If you have like a good handle on like the way Pokemon fight each other, and I don't really yet, but if you did, I think this would be a blast.
Well, see, because you know, every game they usually have like a beauty contest or the pageant or the acting portion. And as much as I love dressing up a Snivy with a little mustache and a top hat and a cane, like in that awkward zombie comic, I'm just so excited to fight a mechanical Tyranitar in a movie and make money. Like, for some reason, that just totally blows my mind, and I'm really excited about it. But
I think you'll enjoy it, because I think this, it's a part of the game that seems very specifically engineered to people who have been playing the game for a while. Because if you don't have a good handle on the way the intricacies of Pokemon fighting, then it's hard to know how to get the battle to unfold the way you want it to. Like, for instance, I'll try not to get too into details, but there's one that says you have to specifically kill one of the opponent's Pokemon, and it's not the one he starts off with. And I didn't realize that one of my attacks made him switch Pokemon until, like, the third time I tried it. I just knew that one of them was not a battle move, so I didn't try it, because I figured I only have, like, a few rounds to kill this guy, so I can't waste around with, like, lowering his defense or something. So I kept trying to tackle him over and over again. I was getting nowhere, and then finally it dawned on me that the other move made him switch guys. And I was like, oh, well, shit. If I had ever played a Pokemon game before, I'd probably know that.
Okay, so there's a few things we gotta mention here. So as someone who's been around since every single main series game and just beat this game, I think the big issue here is that you're probably playing the single hardest to get into Pokemon game for someone who's never played a Pokemon game before. Because there has never been a sequel before that's, like, very direct in this sense. And as the game gets on, what I noticed is it was very un-Nintendo and Pokemon-like that they make no concessions to, like, sort of make it accessible for someone who's never played. They just assume you've played Black and White before, so they don't spend very much time at all to explain things, which is why...
Well, I mean, but you can't really fault them on that. I mean, it is literally the sequel to a game. So, I mean, it's like, you know, how sometimes Legend of Zelda will assume, oh, heart equals life. You know,
yeah,
this,
I mean,
fairies equal healing, because that's Legend of Zelda. You know Zelda is going to get kidnapped and you must save her.
Like, I'm not holding any of these things against the game. Like, I'm aware of that. Like, it doesn't bother me that much, because I'm the one coming into the series at, like, the 20th game or whatever that they've released. Like, the series has been around for a long time. I don't expect them to give me a Tetris tutorial whenever I pick up a Tetris game. So, I mean, I'm with you on that. It does feel like a Pokemon game designed for people who've been playing Pokemon for a long time, and that's perfectly fine. It is a sequel. It doesn't bother me. But yeah, you're right. It is making my entrance into the series with this game a little harder than it probably could have been, but I think part of that is because I'm still trying to play this game like I play other RPGs, which is kind of, I don't tend to mess around with finesse when I play RPGs, which is probably the reason I don't play a lot of RPGs, because I'm not that good at them for the most part. I tend to stick with what's powerful and bludgeon my way through whatever fight that I'm in. And yeah, you can't do that with this game, because you'll find out very quickly that your Pokemon that has the bludgeoning skills is weak to just about everything that your opponents will throw at him. Except for other bludgeoners, maybe, I don't know. So it's taking a lot of adjustment for me to, like, adapt to the different thought process that goes into battling in a Pokemon game. I will say that one of the things in the story that really jumped out at me is the way that everyone in the world seems to adore Pokemon, but yet this is a game about dogfighting, basically. Like, it's so weird that they say things like, battling with your Pokemon helps strengthen the bond between Pokemon and humans. It's like, what? That doesn't seem right at all. Like, that's such a weird concept to me, but I don't know, it just kind of made me laugh a little bit.
I mean, that is the joke that goes along with Pokemon. And I mean, eventually it just gets to a point where you're like, no, it's so much more than that. Why is it so much more than that? Because we love each other. He'll never give up. He'll never give up. He was my first starter Pokemon. I'll never put him in my PC.
I love you so much, Snivy or Snivy. Now go fight him to the death if you don't mind. I'm sorry.
Exactly.
To the faint.
But okay, so, you know, Alex, let's start with you because, you know, Andy's been, you know, telling us about his experience. But Alex, tell me, what is, you know, the number one best part of the Pokemon Black and White 2? And what is also the thing you hate the most about it? And I'm interested because you are a Poke fanatic, and I would honestly love, aside from the story, like, so what is the thing that makes this game so much better than the others and also makes it so much worse than all the others?
So I'll start with the second one.
Okay.
Well, actually, I'll sort of answer both at the same time.
Even better.
So the story, as I've sort of alluded to before, and I directly state in the review, it takes a long time for it to get going. It takes, it's sort of drip-fed to you for the first half of the game, and then it goes full assault after, like, the sixth badge. Which, it's sort of a bummer compared to all the things that were great about Black and White. And everything that you sort of wanted to happen with the story, like the insane return of Getsis, and where N's been this whole time, it's not really addressed as far as you'd like, and nothing really develops. It just sort of, this is their token appearance, this is the story wrapping up in the span of a few hours, here's your legendary Pokemon, and so forth. Now, what's great about it is that, unlike the third version iterations in the past, Yellow, Platinum, Emerald, all those, this has a lot more extra stuff in it than those games. Like, the first 10% of the game is something you've never played before, and the last 10% is something you've never played before. And in between, like, they set you across Unova in a different way than you did in Black and White. There's a lot of new locations sort of spread about, like, in Castellia City, now there's a sewer you get to go through that's kind of cool. And in that desert route, Route 4, where everything was under construction, now it's actually built and you can see what's going on. And actually, as Andy alluded to, there are some new features. Like, there's the PokéStar Studios, which I didn't like so much because I don't really like those mini-games that don't have much to do with the battling. But whatever, if you're into it, that's fine.
Whatever you're into, baby.
And then there's Pokemon World Tournament, which I won't spoil too much about, but as I'm sure you and most other Poke fanatics know, it basically allows you to fight every gym leader and champion from the past if you unlock the tournament to that level.
That is amazing.
It's pretty great. It's exactly as good as you think it is. It's a great replacement for Battle Frontier, even though, like, the subway is still there. And, the only, like, sort of bummer to me as a Pokemon fan is that everyone sort of looks the same as they did in the original games, even though Black and White is, like, 10 years in the future.
Hey, Misty is forever, like, 20.
she's forever, like, 12.
Hey, in the games, she aged.
So I have a question for you guys. When you capture Pokemon, do you give them nicknames?
Usually when I'm doing Nuzlocke.
No, I'm just asking if you do, because it's weird for me, because if I give it a nickname, I'm never going to learn the names of the Pokemon.
But after a time, like, personally, like, once my first time playing through, generally not, unless it's, you know, something I've been trying to catch because I know its name, like, I'll always nickname my Abras. Or, like, my Slackings.
I found one that I liked the look of. It was sort of a tigery thing, although I forget the name of the Pokemon because I gave it a nickname. I called him Pups. And so I was like, this is a guy that I'm going to level up because I like the look of him. And my guess is he probably does some cool stuff.
Is it Lillipup?
Yeah, that might be right. It's a little tiger-looking thing.
Was it Growlithe? Was it fire?
Oh, it's Growlithe then, probably.
Yeah, Growlithe, that sounds right. But I gave him a nickname, so I immediately forgot the name of the Pokemon, and aside from going into the menu to look at him, like, I just completely forgot it immediately. So I almost feel like I don't want to give anybody a nickname, not until I've played the game enough that I recognize a whole shit ton of different Pokemon. Only one who's I recognize at sight is only like maybe four or five that I immediately know what they're called when I see them, and those are the ones that you fight over and over again in the first like 2 hours of the game.
Okay, so for me, I'm a little different where I don't like nicknaming my Pokemon at all. Like, even, like, Red and Blue, which I must have played a dozen times by now, I really just like sticking to the names of Pokemon. Though, I guess my reason for doing so would be about as good as anyone's reason for why they nickname all of their Pokemon. It's just how you decide to play it, really.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's the... I'm really 50-50. I don't know what I'm trying to say. I mean, when I'm playing them the first time through, like, when I first played Black and White, like, I had to do that, or else I was, like, Scrafty, there we go, Scrafty. Because I'd named him, like, Little K or something, like, I just do that, you know? But when I'm replaying it, or I'm doing a Nuzlocke run, you know, yeah, you have to nickname him, because then it's like, you know, they're your friends, you know, you give them nicknames, cause, you know, you can, and they can't say no.
Yeah.
Alright, so, final thoughts on the game. Alex?
It's Pokemon, and anyone who cared to listen to this and is a Pokemon fan will love it, and will probably love it despite any fault I said it has. With that said, it's not as good as Black and White.
So basically what you're saying is, this is like the Avengers or Dark Knight. If you're a fan of it, or Dark Knight Rises, sorry, Dark Knight was a great movie no matter what.
Right.
But it's like kind of like Avengers or Dark Knight Rises. You know, there are tons of flaws in both of them. And, you know, if you're not a fan, they're not really great movies. But if you are, then you know, they're amazing, which is why I love them.
Exactly. Like, as I said in my abstract, it's as great as it has ever been, but it's not much better.
All right. Andy?
Was Black and White considered to be sort of the best Pokemon game when it came out?
I mean, yes and no. I mean,
everyone has their favorite.
Well, yeah, no, yeah. I mean, just saying universally reviewed, I think Soul Silver and Heart Gold still have, like, they're the closest to perfect, like, reviewed Pokemon games.
Ew.
Everything else. Oh, don't ew it. Soul Silver is the best game ever. Soul Silver is the best game ever.
No heart and no soul. It's just a straight remake and there's no emotional.
Oh, go back to the third generation.
I will, Joshua. I will.
Andy?
There was one thing that happened towards the very beginning of the game that sort of drives home the point that I was making earlier about how this definitely feels like an iteration upon an iteration upon an iteration, layer after layer of refinement over a very simple core premise. When I first started playing and I got control over my character for the very first time, I walked around and thought, oh my god, this is so ridiculously slow. I can't fathom playing an RPG where I walk this slowly. I'm going to throw my 3DS. But then, before I got out of the first city, I was given an item that allowed me to run, which I expected to happen at some point, because I think that happened in Pearl as well. But you can't possibly have gotten that item so soon in the game in previous Pokemon games, at least not all of them. And that's kind of what I mean when I say, why did I have to even ever walk around slowly in the first place? Well, because that's the way it was done before, and then you get an item to make you go faster. It feels like an unnecessary step. Why can't they just make you walk at a decent speed instead of giving you an item? And you know, maybe there's a part in the game where you have the potential to lose that item later, and that's why it's an item instead of just not fixed in the design in the first place.
Nope.
But that's kind of what it feels like. It feels like, well, in past Pokemon games, you walk slow for a while, and then after a while, you found an item to walk fast, and so that's the way this one works too. It just so happens that they give it to you so early that it doesn't really ever matter that it's an item. And that sort of just illustrates my feelings about this game in general. There's, even having never played previous Pokemon games, there's so many things about this that scream, yeah, this is a layer upon a layer upon a layer of refinement. But it doesn't bother me. I'm really enjoying it. I'm looking forward to seeing kind of how my enjoyment of it changes once I get a better handle on the way the Pokemon are supposed to fight each other and the weaknesses and the strengths and how to use the various bonus items, which I'm still sort of a little bit fuzzy about. But I really think that I really have an appreciation for the complexity of the Pokemon battling. I saw a website that had a grid of the different types and how they fought against each other, and I thought, oh my god, there's a lot to this that I'd not even begun to sink my teeth into. And that's like, you know, 6-7 hours into the game, and I really haven't even had a chance to get into that yet. And I would assume what's going to happen is at some point I'm going to come across a battle I can't win until I figure this out. So we'll see what happens when I get there.
Well, Andy, I would just be interested, one last sort of thing. I would be sort of interested if after this is all tucked away, you've done your review, and you don't have the obligation to play Pokemon Black and White 2 ever again, I would be interested to see what your thoughts on the original Black and White are. As in, a totally fresh story, it's probably the best game for newcomers since the original games. Okay. It's very easy. I think if you like this, but you're a little confused, Black and White might be the perfect game for you.
Right on.
Agreed.
I might have to give that a shot.
All right then. Gentlemen, thank you very much for coming and talking to me and feeding my inner fanboy, some, you know, much needed pre-release goodies.
Yeah, 3 days left, Josh. 3 days.
You have no idea how excited I am for Sunday. You have no idea.
You are correct. I don't.
I reordered it. I put the money down. I just need to physically pick it up. Ah, I'm leaving my 3DS charged until then. You're, just so I know I can play it.
You're not gonna play it on like a DSi, the proper way?
I only have a 3DS now. On me.
I sold my DSi the second I could because I don't have enough money to hold on to the things I don't need anymore.
Alright, this is neither here nor there. Gentlemen, yes. Thank you again for coming out and talking.
You're welcome.
And to everyone else, we'll see you online.
Bye.
Bye.
Newscast-like segment on connectivity. I'm your host, Neil Rodahan, and with me for this news/what-you've-been-playing is Patrick Barnett and Scott Thompson.
Hello.
Hello, everyone.
Yeah. So we were originally planning to just do a what-you've-been-playing segment. However, Nintendo is just fucked in the head right now. Really, there's no other way to say it. We were doing the math. By the time you guys hear this, there will have been 6 Nintendo Directs within a span of like 8 days, 4 in Japan, 1 in North America, and 1 in Europe. So that's crazy pants. And I think the earliest we found out about any of them was we found out about the Animal Crossing one that's forthcoming about 3 days before. 2 of the Japan ones we found out literally when they were live. It's really messed up at this point. But there was a lot of news.
Well, yeah, basically Nintendo decided to release like a month's worth of news and within a week.
Yeah, it's kind of funny because I've been talking with our Nintendo of America rep and just like about everything that's going on, and I think, like, she's getting married soon. So I can only imagine what hell they must be going through. Because there's a lot of stuff, and there's, like, you know, that big elephant in the room of Wii U that they have to prepare for as well.
Yeah.
So, I mean, tough for us, tough for them, too. Pat, the PR rep that you don't have to talk to on the back, because they do a tough job. Anyway, let's go right to the news. When we get to what you've been playing, we will talk about New Super Mario Bros. 2 DLC then, because that's kind of, I guess, the more marquee news that came out of all this, and I downloaded and played it, so I'll talk about that later. But now let's go to the other cool eShop stuff. First and foremost, there's going to be a sequel to Pushmo, guys.
Woo!
Fucking awesome is that?
It's the best day ever.
Yeah, it's called Crashmo in North America, or Fall Blocks in Europe. And we had some back and forth between our North American and European contingent. I believe some of the North Americans called Fall Blocks Fail Blocks. And then one of the members of the European group was just like, Mo's not even a word. So there's that. But I think they're just both dumb names, but I can't wait for this game.
What was it originally called in Europe? What was Pushmo?
It was Pull Blocks.
Pull Blocks, yeah.
Okay, well.
So they're both going along the same thing. I mean, the whole mechanic in this, I mean, there's, you know, more training levels, more new levels, just new content. But gravity is being added to the puzzle blocks. So basically, like, they don't stay in place. They'll fall as you play, which, you know, makes it slightly different. I guess it makes things crash and or fall.
So basically, while it took 20 years for Mario to start messing with gravity in interesting ways, Pushmo's done it now in, like, a two-year span.
Yeah.
So.
Year and a half, not even.
Yeah.
I assume it's developed by Intelligent Systems, but I don't know if that's 100% confirmed. It would be kind of ridiculous if it wasn't. Yeah. But I know, Patrick, you love the crap out of Pushmo, so how excited are you on a scale of 9 to 15?
I didn't find out about that. Probably 16. Yeah, I didn't hear about it right away, and then when it was like an hour later and I found out about this, I was just like, what?
Yeah, and it was kind of shocking.
Yeah. I don't expect that a sequel to an eShop game would be coming so soon. I mean, it is happening with the Denpa Men, but...
It kind of makes sense, because they're not really long development cycles, and I think that's part of the why people should be making great eShop games, because they're on a smaller scale. I mean, you think with Denpa Men, I mean, you're 2 years into development on that game, and you've already come out with two, and Mutant Muds is going to be the same way.
Yeah, it's just how many sequels to eShop games have been released so far, just the Denpa Men.
Yeah.
So... We're kind of in that era where we're going to start seeing sequels to these games that we loved last year.
Yeah, which is great. I mean, as long as we see sequels to good games, which that's what's happening, it just seems to be on a much quicker development schedule than the bigger games. And I think that is the glory of downloadable games. But, yeah, it's coming out November 22nd, so like 4 days after Wii U.
Yeah, that's probably the only downside.
Yeah, I mean, this will be the kind of game that I'll play whenever I get it. I'll probably end up getting it when it comes out, but it might be the kind of thing where I get it and not actually play it until, like, Christmas.
Yeah, it'll sit wrapped in that nice little packaging on your 3DS yeah. home screen.
I'll open it Christmas morning. I'll be like, oh thanks, me.
I don't think you'll be able to last that long.
Yeah, I probably won't. I'll have to poop sometime, and that'll be the perfect game to play while pooping.
You'll make it maybe a day, and then you'll cave.
But, yeah, I'm very, very excited for this game. I think we all are. And I think if you haven't played Pushmo, what the hell are you doing? I think it's on sale in Europe, so get it if you haven't. And even if you didn't, I think it's, what, $7?
It's not overly priced.
Yeah.
For the amount of content that's in that game.
I didn't even finish the first one. I mean, now I might go back, actually.
I didn't finish it either.
Yeah, there is a lot of content
right at the end. It just gets obscenely hard.
It gets very hard.
Yes.
But, yeah, the other thing that we found out, and this is, we've already kind of talked about this game before, but Fluidity Spin Cycle got a release date of December 27th, so that'll be right after, that'll be what I'll get post-Christmas for myself. And then I'll see that wrapped eShop game on my 3DS and just be like, oh man, me, you shouldn't have. And that game's also coming out to Europe in December under its European name, Hydro Venture Spin Cycle.
I think I like Hydro Venture better than Fluidity.
It's once again, it's kind of like Crash Mode Fallbox, but I don't really give a shit. The game's awesome.
I'm just saying, I think Europe's got that one on us. Crash Mode, yeah. Better than Fallbox, but they've got us on Fluidity.
Now, what we do have them on is the fact that they don't have any confirmation of Tokyo Crash Mobs coming out in Europe. This is going to be an early 2013 eShop release in North America, and this is that weird pedestrian throwing game that came out in Japan over the summer on the eShop. It's by Mitchell Corporation. They made Puzzle Loop and Magnetica, which if those names seem unfamiliar with you, I'll just say it by the name that you know it as, because PopCap ripped them off, Zuma. But instead of being a frog shooting balls, it's you're like some female businesswoman who's throwing people.
Makes sense.
Into groups of other people. There's actually some kind of plot to this game where it's like these two people are, you know, trying to like get to work or something. I don't know. It looks ridiculous. I'm very excited for this game because I love games like Magnetica and Zuma, and the aesthetic and style of this is awesome.
I remember when they first showed this game off during a Nintendo Direct probably 5 or 6 months ago.
Yeah, I think it was April, maybe?
It was either April or June, but the initial reaction from everyone was that this is never going to get localized.
Yeah, and it is. I mean, that's, once again, the glory of eShop is I think we have a lot more likelihood of things getting localized because it's a lot smaller risk.
Yeah. And it's probably cheap, too.
at this point, I guess North America still hasn't gotten Picross E, but I don't think there's any major like Nintendo-made eShop game that isn't slated to come to North America and Europe. I don't think so.
There might be
something sort of recent. Oh, Harmonite. We still haven't heard anything on Harmonite, but way it seems to be going,
yeah.
I mean, like that will come eventually. There's not really any doubt in my mind. That'll probably be 2013, though, by the looks of it.
Yeah. Probably early 2013 as well.
Yeah. But that's what our eShop for the... And then the October game that they highlighted was Night Sky, which is the Nicholas game. So we've got marquee eShop games coming out once a month from now until, I would assume, January. I would think that the early 2013 means that Tokyo Crash Mobs might not be a January release, but I think it will be. And the other big news is that Level 5 is finally doing that international publishing that they kept on threatening for a number of years. they open up offices, and I know North America, I think there's a European office too. Don't quote me on that. But either way, Level 5 is bringing 3 of the 4 Guild Zero 1 games to the 3DS eShop in Europe and North America. In Europe, the first one, Liberation Maiden, which is made by Suda51 and Grasshopper, along with, you know, folks from Level 5. That is already out in Europe for what looks like it'll be about $10 when it comes to North America soon. And for those who don't know, Liberation Maiden is, a shooter in the same vein as, like, you know, fast-paced action side-scrolling shooters. I don't know the full...
At first glance, it kind of reminded me of Kid Icarus.
I think it's a lot more of a traditional shooter than that.
Yeah, it was just that initial, like, touchscreen that I saw.
The story is what's winning about it, is that, like, it's the shooter where I think you're in a robot or a mech or some shit, and you play the, like, 15-year-old president of Japan because your father has been assassinated. Like, what the fuck?
It's got me already.
And it's called Liberation Maiden, which, after knowing that and then going back to the title, it's ridiculous. I don't really like shooters that much, but just because I'm so glad to see the Guild Zero 1 games, except for one of them, which I don't know too much about. I know, we'll have to get Danny Bivens on at some point to talk Guild Zero 1 with us. But one of them's not making it over. And that appears to be some sort of like rental shop RPG, which I don't really know why that one's not making it over unless that'll come later. I don't know why I didn't get in this announcement. And for those who don't know, Guild Zero 1 is just this thing that Level 5 did where they work with notable designers on these kind of like, not mini games, but just smaller concept games. The other two that are coming out, they're slated for November and December, respectively, in Europe and in North America just before the end of the holiday season for all three. One's from Yute Saito, the guy who did, like, Sim Tower and Odama. It's called Aeroporter, which, as far as I know, it's basically like a luggage management game. It's kind of like a fast-paced, like, sort the luggage as fast as you can.
And you may have turned me off from this by saying Odama. Yeah.
I don't think you're going to be, like, you know, playing the bongos and yelling at your 3DS. Although that would have made Odama better if they used the bongos. They didn't. That wasn't an early version of the game. And the third game is an RPG called Crimson Shroud that is headed up by Yasumi Matsuno, who's best known for working on stuff like Final Fantasy Tactics and Vagrant Story. I recall hearing when Guild Zero One first came out in Japan that this was kind of like the gem of it. I could be wrong, but Crimson Shroud is like it's a traditional SRPG in which I think that the plot is that like, it's 1,000 years in the past, and you, in a world that, that currently has magic, but in the past they don't, and you find out how they get magic, or something like that. I've heard very good things about it, and, I guess I kind of see why that's the third one to come out. It also seems like it might be the best one.
Yeah.
So are you guys kind of interested in any of these games, or no?
Definitely Crimson Shroud after you just described that.
Yeah.
So in describing these games, you sold Patrick on two of the three, it sounds like.
Yes, yes. The airport simulator did not.
In all honesty, Aeroporter is like the one I want the most just because of how fucking stupid it sounds.
It depends how cheap that one.
I have a feeling they're all probably going to be $10.
$10, I don't think I could justify an airport simulator.
But yeah, no, I mean, this sounds cool. I mean, this is a really neat initiative, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's a game that pretty much everyone was like, that's never coming over here.
Was this a retail game? Like, just
all
these games on one cart? Okay.
Yep.
Yeah, this
they
is
are
cool.
Making Guild Zero 2, correct, already?
Yes.
In Japan?
I don't know if it's out yet, though.
Yeah.
It might be coming soon. I kind of haven't really followed them too closely, because I thought there was no shot in hell of them coming to Japan. But, to America. They did come to Japan, that's where they were made.
Assuming these do well, I can only guess that Guild 2, those games will come over as well.
I mean, it's a really smart strategy, I think, for level 5 to kind of, you know, bring people in that way. Because it's a lot more of a risk to take on publishing your own games at retail. And instead of publishing their own games at retail, they're publishing them digitally and kind of getting a foothold. I mean, I'm not too up on what Level 5 does, but I know, like, they were hot as shit around when, like, the first Layton or two came out. And they put a lot of money into development and making these big games. I know Ni No Kuni, the thing that they did with Studio Ghibli, kind of didn't really do as well as they thought. And I think they've been having to deal with a little bit with financial struggles. I mean, not to the point that, like, they're going to shut down or anything. But I think their ambitions got cut down a little bit. And it seems like this is how they're going to do their overseas publishing. And it seems like it's going to be pretty smart. I mean, it's what a lot of companies like XSEED and Atlas do, where they're doing a lot more digital now than they used to. Ignition is the same way. I mean, that's how we wound up even Ignition with Western games, because that's how we wound up with Order Up and Planet Crashers 3D being on the eShop, was because they kind of wanted to go more digital and stay out of retail, which I think it's really smart.
All of those companies also bring, in my opinion, at least the best games to digital content.
Yeah.
Like, most of everything that they release digitally is what I buy.
Yep. So we'll move on to retail games coming to eShop, which I'll run it down and then we can see if there's any chance of hell of any of us ever spending full retail price on games that we likely already own. So in Europe, available now, and available on October 18th in North America, and these are all for full price, Mario Kart 7, Super Mario 3D Land, Legend of Zelda Ocarina of Time 3D, and Star Fox 64 3D will all be available to be bought on the eShop. And you know, so you can play it on your system without the use of a card. There was no, in Japan, it's those four titles, along with Mario Tennis Open, some Nature Book bullshit, Pilot Wings Resort, and Mario and Sonic at the London Olympic Games. Those are all coming on November 1st in Japan. In Japan, they mentioned a save transfer capability where, like, you could, you know, the example that they used was you could take your Mario Kart 7 save data, move it from the cartridge to your SD card, and then use that save data in the downloaded version of Mario Kart. But that's not coming until spring. So we didn't hear anything about that in North America and Europe, but I assume that will come eventually. It's just kind of, I mean, it's a matter of time, but even still, there is a part of me that knows that when these fucking things come out, I'm going to be like, whoa, I totally need Mario Kart twice.
well, because there's like there's two things.
There is that really big convenience.
The convenience, and it's too bad it's not launching with these games coming out, but the ability to transfer your save data over totally makes it like, well, I might as well do it because all my stuff will be there, but it'll always be on the system this way, you know? But
You could also transfer or buy the digital content, transfer your save data over, and then just sell your retail copy.
You could. That's very true. And I mean, I think that's something that, I mean, looking at least these list of four games that they're going to start with, I could see myself doing that with Mario Kart without really batting an eye. Cause I mean, that's the thing is that like, it's not like these games, especially these four games, it's not like if you do the save data transfer, or even if you just bite the bullet and are just like, fuck it, I'll just get rid of the game and just start fresh. You could probably, you know, sell each game if you wanted to for $20 to $30, maybe. I don't know. I might be overselling it, depending on the game. But, I mean, for the convenience of playing Mario Kart 7 off of my 3DS, I'd probably pay $15-$20 for that. You know, kind of like net loss. That's something that really appeals to me. Super Mario 3D Land, I don't think there's any chance of hell. I've beaten that game almost to 100%. I'm stuck on the very, very last level that you unlock. I don't really have any need to have that on my system, although I think I'd heavily consider it if it was new now. Ocarina of Time 3D is kind of the same way. That's not a game that I'm going to like pick up and play randomly. Star Fox 64 3D is a game that I could see thinking about, but not to double dip on that. I've already technically double dipped on that game twice.
Yeah, that's true. Why not make it a third?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's the only thing that would prevent me from picking these up right away is the fact that they're going to be the full $40. Whereas, like, if you hadn't bought these games yet, you could, at this point, get them used for at least half off.
Well, I mean, they're still Nintendo games, so probably not.
What about Pilot Wings? Is that still $40?
We don't know the Japan prices yet.
Okay.
It can't be.
Like, that is retailing now for, what, 20 probably?
Yeah, if Pilot Wings is more than the equivalent of $20, well, I guess in Japan everything's more expensive anyway. But, you know, when Pilot Wings Resort comes to download in North America, if it's more than $20, they're fucking crazy.
Well, that in Mario and Sonic at the Olympic Games, like, that does not need to be full price.
Yeah.
But it's cool. I mean, it's great to see them going back and putting old games on here. I mean, you know that they're going to do it from here on out with first-party games, but the fact that they're putting in this effort to increase this digital library of full games is great, I think.
And because I think that some people listening to us will probably give a shit about this, as far as anyone who's curious about how we get our review codes or review copies from now on, I mean, traditionally with Nintendo games, we would get physical copies. And I've actually kind of gotten an answer with that pretty much with every game, whether we like it or not, we're just going to get a code. They did make the comment that like stuff like Professor Layton will probably still get the physical game, but for most other games, we're probably just going to get the code. So that's for, I know there's some people that like the inside baseball knowledge of that. But yeah.
Which I don't know. I'm okay with, I think. I mean, it depends what game you're reviewing. Like, I'll be reviewing Paper Mario in a little bit, and I feel like that's a game I'd hold on to regardless. Yeah. So I'm fine with getting the digital copy. But if you're reviewing something that's not quite as good, you know, a lot of times we review these games and then we sell them.
Yeah.
And, you know, make a little money.
I mean, generally, if it is Nintendo games, then I don't think we'll have that much to worry about.
No.
But, I mean, I guess I'll just go into that debate for a little bit, because I've been really scratching my brain over, like, what am I going to do? Like, I know Crosswords Plus, when I eventually get that, like, that is a downloadable game no matter what. It's just $30 is kind of much. But with, like, Layton and Paper Mario, I'm honestly torn. Although I think it might be the kind of case where I get them digitally out of convenience. I'll be, October 28th, when Layton comes out, I will be in Green Bay, Wisconsin, watching the Jaguars play the Packers. So I will have a flight home. I do not know if I will be able to go to the store to go get it. So I'll probably download that game because I want to play it. And the same thing on November 11th when Paper Mario comes out. My sister's getting married that day, so I might be up at midnight the night before downloading Paper Mario and playing it. And that's the kind of thing, is that it might just be that matter of convenience for me, because I don't think I'd get rid of either game, but at the same time, like, there is that niceness of having the physical item.
Even but just you can lend like it to people.
Yeah, it's not like I'm going to get rid of Layton or Paper Mario, though, but, like, I would be able to, like, you know, be like, oh, man, Paper Mario was great. I beat that a while ago. You got a 3DS now. Sure, I'll lend it to you, but now I can't. I don't know. I still have a month to figure it all
out.
And,
like, you kind of alluded to it when you were talking about the games that are announced that are going to come out soon, these older games. But to me, it really depends on the style of game. So, like, New Super Mario Bros. 2, great. Like, that's a perfect pick-up-and-play game. So I like that being installed on the system.
Yeah. I played it a lot more because it's installed on the system.
Yes, because it's always with you, which is great. But, like, yeah, you said, like something like Paper Mario, where that's not really that type of game. Like, that is something that might be, I don't know if better, but you might
also
prefer.
The box art's really awesome for that game.
Yeah. I do like having boxes.
Yeah, there's some value with that. I mean, even Inside Baseball Talk as well. For Wii U, when we get that, we'll probably get the first wave, you know, the Nintendo Land and the Super Mario Bros. U, Ninja Gaiden, Sing Party. We'll probably get that all physically, because our Nintendo rep made a comment about how, like, you know, we want you to have the physicality of having the new boxes and stuff like that. Because, I mean, honestly, that is exciting. I have a feeling pretty much everyone, when they see their first Wii U box in person, you're going to have to pick it up, inspect it, and look at it. It's going to be cool.
There's always that joy of opening the box of new hardware. I mean, software's different, but hardware especially.
Dude, the 3DS cases were so weird. Because it's like, this is exactly like a DS case, but it's so light.
I hope, when we get this, that Tyler can make another really amazing unboxing video.
Yeah. but then after Wii U launch, we're probably going to get all the games downloadable.
Even third party or only first party?
That's still the Nintendo answer for that is, well, you'll have to ask the third parties about that. I don't think we're going to see any third party games downloadable at launch, but I guess the option exists. I mean, we'll see. It really, to be completely honest, Nintendo has no idea what the hell they're doing with these digital retail games. They're really, because they don't want to go full bore into it, because I don't know if you guys followed anything with Sony with their day one digital stuff where you get like, you get a small discount for downloading games the day they come out digitally, or at least for certain games. But retailers got pissed. I mean, that's the thing, is like, it's the risk you run. I don't really, well, actually I can tell you why no one really cares about some of the Vita games being discounted digitally when they come out, because no retailer gives a fuck about the Vita.
I honestly never see any Vita displays.
Whenever you see them,
anywhere.
It's just like, the Vita's coming out in February!
yeah, but I mean, I guess it'll depend on the third party. I mean, like you alluded to, a lot of third parties already do release their games digitally on the PS3 or the Vita. I mean, like, you could buy right now NHL 13, Resident Evil 6, Borderlands 2. I mean, you could buy and download those from the PS3 store, like, right now.
Yep.
And so, like, those companies, you know, like EA,
Well, EA fucking hates Nintendo, so that's not happening.
Well, okay, I guess that's true. But companies
I mean,
who are open to doing
Ubisoft,
it already.
Maybe.
There you go, yeah, who's like Nintendo's boyfriend.
Yeah.
We'll gladly do it.
What happened was Nintendo and EA broke up, and then Ubisoft was just like, hey baby, you want to give us some early hardware? We'll make you a zombie game, baby, it'll be okay. You want a new Rayman, baby? We got it for you. Or I guess maybe you have to do it with a French accent or something.
Yeah. Which I'm not going to attempt. Yeah. If any of you want to, feel free. But
send in you doing a fake accent. Fake French accent with that.
New contest, yeah. People send in voice clips of you you doing a French accent trying to wine and dine Nintendo. As it would be.
As a prize, do they get to be on the show doing their voice?
No.
they'll get Neil's early copy of the Wii U, hardware.
Yeah.
So.
That's not going to happen, guys. Sorry. just gonna clear that up now. So before we get on to what you've been playing, we've already been talking quite a lot about seemingly nothing, but it's fun. We like it. We got a virtual console lineup for North America that's kind of exciting. And first I'm going to read the list that Nintendo presented to us today, and then I'm going to read a list of games that were confirmed for release in the second half of the year, earlier in the year by Nintendo. Mostly from the mid-August press release that gave us the release date for Paper Mario and all that jazz. So what Nintendo confirmed to us today was that Mario Golf is coming on October 11th. That's next Thursday, and that's the Game Boy Color version of that game. Castlevania The Adventure, the Game Boy game, is coming out on October 25th. On November 8th, 2 weeks later, Ninja Gaiden, the NES game, will be coming to 3DS Virtual Console. I will totally buy the shit out of that. On November 22nd, the same day as Crash Mo, Zelda 2 The Adventure of Link, the Ambassador game, will be coming out. So that means I'll probably actually play that game because it'll have save states. On December 20th, Wario Land 2 will finally make it to North America. And on December 27th, we will get Super Mario Bros. The Lost Levels, the NES version.
And so many stupid poor suckers will buy that.
Yeah. I mean, I own that on Super Mario All-Stars, but I've not really ever played the original NES version. But anyway, so there's that list. Six games through the rest of the year, two in each month that they highlighted. But then we have this other list that I mean, negatively, you know what? We might just get these six games. But there's a chance. For Game Gear, we know that Sonic Blast, Sonic Drift 2, Sonic Labyrinth, and Columns should be coming out before the end of the year. On the NES, Gradius should be coming out on the 3DS Virtual Console. On the original Game Boy, we should be getting Kirby Star Stacker and Kirby Stream Land 2 at some point. And according to the Kirby Stream Collection book, they're already out in North America, when in reality, they're just out in Europe and Japan. And then on Game Boy Color, we should be getting Shantae before the end of the year, and I think that should be happening. I don't think WayForward's full of that much shit. And then Harvest Moon on Game Boy Color and Legend of the River King, both Natsume games, and Natsume is celebrating some anniversary for Harvest Moon this year, and in a recent press release, they mentioned that Harvest Moon on Game Boy Color will be hitting the eShop at some point this year. So, we could have a veritable buffet of Virtual Console games, and there's a lot of quality in there. I'm very excited to play some of those.
I'm glad to see the Virtual Consoles finally back in full swing. There was that period before E3 where it was just dead.
Yeah. I mean, they've been relatively consistent. And
ever since the Summer of Arcade, I think it's been picking back up.
Well, I would say August was kind of weak, but then lately it seems like at least every other week we're getting a Virtual Console game. And I really like when they give us a release list like this. Because,
yeah, I was going to say, this is the big news to me.
Yeah, I mean, even this, it's like, okay, two a month, but that's two a month. And we could see other ones in between those weeks too. But at a minimum, we know that we're getting two Virtual Console games a month, and that's something that I think is really imperative for Nintendo to do in every region. It's just, hey, you know what, there might not be a Virtual Console game this week, but guys, it's okay. Castlevania The Adventure is coming out next week. No one's okay with that.
It's kind of weird how they space it out, though. I mean, it starts off where it's almost like the beginning of the end of the month, because you've got Mario Golf next week and Castlevania.
Well, it's every 2 weeks until Mario Land 2 and Lost Levels are right after each other.
Right, but you have like a month between Zelda 2 and Wario Land 2, November 22nd and then December 20th.
I mean, that's why I hope. It's not even like they're getting out of the way of other eShop games, because Zelda 2 is coming out on the same day as Crash Mo, and Super Mario Bros. Lost Levels is coming out on the same day as Fluidity.
Right.
It's weird.
It is.
And on that note, let's go to what you've been playing. Scott, you're up first with this week's big release, Resident Evil 6.
Perfect. Perfect.
If you want to hear about a good Resident Evil game, we talked about Resident Evil 4 for the Lifetime Achievement Award that it won for our Best of the Week. So go listen to that.
That came out, by the time you're hearing this, it came out the day before this. It came out on Friday. So.
Yep.
And I want to start with talking about Resident Evil 4 for just a second here. Patrick, have you played the game?
No.
Okay. I had a feeling that was the case. But Neil, I know you have.
Yeah.
And as we know, the game starts out, Leon's being driven by these two guides down this, path and in some vaguely Eastern European country. I don't know if it's ever said exactly where he is. Probably.
I think it's made up.
Yeah, but I wouldn't doubt it. And, there's a lot of tension. You know, Leon gets out of the car and he's walking down this path, and then you get into the town and you see this, like, weird ritual going on. And you can kind of explore before you even really start fighting the enemies. Like, if you're careful with it, you can kind of look around and really get a feel for that first town before you engage the enemies. But after a little bit, you end up inside one of the houses, and you push like bookcases to board the doors and the windows and stuff, and slowly they start breaking in, and it's this very like slow build up to this great like payoff, and there's a lot of tension. And even with Resident Evil 5, it starts where Chris Redfield is, you know, exploring this town in Africa, and all the like townsfolk are like looking at him and like observing him, and it's not until you get into the game for a little bit that you find the first like quote unquote zombie. I always forget what they call them now because they aren't zombies, but
who knows?
Yeah, you get the idea. Well, in Resident Evil 6, there's basically like a little bit of a training level before the game really opens up. And it starts with this huge explosion, like on a city street, and then you're Leon from first person perspective, and you're dragging your partner down the street, like into an alleyway. And first of all, you have to tap X to move her and to move yourself, and then to look around as you're doing that, you use the right stick, which already means that you're moving your left hand over to the right stick on the controller to try to look around while you're pressing X rapidly to move. And like the first like 2 minutes is all just like a bunch of quick time events that are just like really poorly done. So then you make it, you make her a little like green herb concoction and heal her, and then you get back out onto the street. And so not only are you making your way through a bunch of zombies and like cars, like you're on a highway, a fighter jet crashes into like the side of a building and then like lands in front of you and blocks your path. So then you have to turn around and you're running. And then a helicopter comes, and a soldier gets out, and he's like, hurry, get on the helicopter, and he's just shooting a bunch of people with machine guns. And then he gets, what happened? I think like a tanker or something falls into the hole where the plane was, and so it makes this huge explosion. You and your partner get on the helicopter, but he's engulfed in flames. You begin to fly away. The helicopter pilot suddenly dies and turns into a zombie. So then Leon has to grab controls of the helicopter and crash land it, and then you crash into like a building. And then there's one final quick time event as you like jump out of the way as the helicopter, which is like hanging from wreckage, begins to like fall on you where you fell out of the helicopter. And like that's like the opening training level. I mean, this is like the first 10 minutes of the game is all of this.
Weird.
And it kind of sets the tone for the whole game, really. If anyone's been following the reviews, like, you've heard the complaints that it's like, at this point, it's just all action game. Like, there's no suspense, there's no, like, thrills whatsoever. And that, as far as I've seen, I've played about an hour and a half at this point. Like, that's absolutely the case. There's not any scares, there's not any moments where you're trying to be careful. I mean, it's just a run-and-gun game at this point. And that would be okay if it was done well, but like it just controls really poorly for a game of that design. First of all, at least in Leon's campaign, I've seen videos where it's like there's stuff in daytime and it's easy to see stuff, but in Leon's campaign, it's like pitch black, and I've turned the brightness all the way up in the menu settings, which I've never done with a game before, and like I still can't see things when I'm like in hallways and stuff, like so I'll just be walking around and I will like literally bump into zombies because I can't see them, and like it's just terrible. And then the zombies, I mean, they could virtually just be any enemy from any game. I mean, they don't necessarily act like zombies, which is okay. I mean, in 4 and 5, you know, they're different, they're faster and they run at you and they have weapons, but I mean, it just feels like you could be playing any generic action shooter. You know, it's just, and this, the enemies look like zombies instead of anything else. They have like bottles and different weapons, they'll throw them at you and they'll run at you, and for the most part you just end up getting like overwhelmed and you have to use your melee attack, which is just like really clumsy, and I don't know, it's just not any fun. Like that's the bottom line. I'm just not having any fun with it right now.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Did you play Resident Evil Revelations, Scott?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I love Revelations.
And you like that one?
Yes, okay. A whole lot. I thought that was really good. I thought, because it kind of returned to, like,
I didn't know how this compares to that.
Not well.
Yeah, I mean, it's the kind of thing where, like, I realized this when I played Revelations and didn't really get too blown over by it, is that I really hate the Resident Evil games, with the exception of 4. So I enjoyed Revelations, but I just, you know, got to a point where I'm just like, I just don't really care.
And, like, Revelations was kind of a little bit more of, like, a throwback to the classic games.
Yeah.
It kept some of the elements of the newer games, but it really...
There is one thing that I remember people complaining about in Revelations that I've heard is kept on in Resident Evil 6, is that in Revelations, people complained about how you would shoot the monsters and they wouldn't really show any signs of stopping. They'd be, like, bullet sponges. And I've heard that's the same case in Resident Evil 6. Is that true?
Not really. Oh, I mean, okay. It depends. In some of the like more frantic moments where there's a lot of zombies coming in at you, I mean, that does seem to kind of be the case, but I think that's just because there's so much going on. But when you're when you're fighting just one zombie and he's like coming at you down a long corridor and you have a chance to pick him off, I mean, you know, you can, if he's holding something, you shoot him in the hand and he drops it. You can see, like, at some points you can see like wounds actually being inflicted to him. So like if you shoot him in the chest, you'll see a hole in his chest and stuff. So I don't think that's the case. It does seem like they react, you know, as if they're really being shot.
Yeah.
Which isn't the case in Revelations. Yeah, it's kind of just a canned animation, no matter where you're shooting them. So, but yeah, it's just weird. I mean, it's just all action, and it just doesn't control very well, I don't think. And especially when things get tight and you're surrounded and stuff, it's just not fun to play. I mean, that's basically it. And it's kind of too bad because it seems like they really tried to put a lot into the game. I mean, there's some interesting things. I mean, there's 4 separate campaigns you can play, 3 of which are set up to be co-op enabled, like right from the start. So when you even start playing the game, it has you like set up your like network settings before you even start. So like you can set it open or private or just completely offline. So anyone can join your game if it's open, or if it's private, you can invite your friends to come play with you. Or obviously, for offline, you don't have any of that. And, you know, that stuff's kind of cool, and I'm interested to play a co-op. I haven't done that yet, so I'm interested to see how that kind of changes the experience. But, yeah, right now it's just very very bland.
That sucks.
Yeah. And, I mean, I guess going into it, I kind of had a feeling, because I was reading the reviews, you know, the day before the game came out, and none were too favorable. But I just felt like I kind of had to see it for myself, and some of them were like, you know, it's not Resident Evil, but it's a good action game, and I just don't even think it's a good action game. It's just very poor. So, I would avoid this, I guess is what I'm saying. There's not much redeemable for me at this point, but we'll see. I mean, I'm going to finish it. I bought it, so it's not, like, atrocious, but it's just not a lot of fun. So, that's Resident Evil 6.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's okay.
You'll get over it.
So, Patrick, I hear you're reviewing Angry Birds.
I am reviewing Angry Birds, and let me tell you, it is Angry Birds. It is the same Angry Birds that you have come to know and love on your iPhone/Android device. Basically, the game, it features Angry Birds, Angry Birds Seasons, and Angry Birds Rio, and it's just that. It's got the basics, using the touchscreen controls to control the slingshot, and you throw the birds, destroy things, and it's Angry Birds. I mean, you guys have played Angry Birds, I'm sure, right? Okay. So you know it's, like, fun, but not super engrossing. And as a retail game, I'm not sure if I can justify a $30 price tag on this.
No, you can't.
I mean, isn't it already on clearance?
I saw that image where it was, I think someone had it down at like $14.
Yeah.
And even that's like, too much.
So basically, does it do anything interesting with a 3D?
It does that effect where it's just like the birds and the things you're destroying are kind of popped out from the background.
Okay, so.
And the backgrounds like, do have a little bit of depth to
so
them.
So it's basically like the actual, like the Angry Birds playfield that we're used to, that's on the top screen, and on the bottom screen, it's just basically like that kind of
it's
theater
a
rhythm like
shot.
Overlay. Oh, okay, the zoomed in shot.
Yeah.
And so what Angry Birds on Wii U will look like.
Yes. You can control it using the analog stick and the buttons, but it doesn't work.
It's fucking dumb.
Yeah. One thing I did want to complain about was the menu system. It's just so tediously slow because the menu, it's like, it starts out with 6 different boxes, like, you can go to like achievements, trophies, high scores, and then the 3 different games. And the way you select it is by kind of shooting a bird into the screen, kind of like it. And you have to be like so precise.
They thought they were so clever.
Yeah, it just doesn't work because instead of just tapping on the menu, you want to go and you want to play the game. No, you have to sit there and angle your bird and fire it and make sure the trajectory is right so it gets into the first. That's the one thing that really bothered me because I was trying to figure out what each menu did individually. And I was sitting there for a good 10 minutes just going back and forth, trying to aim the birds.
That's awful.
I wouldn't recommend this version of Angry Birds. Not at all.
I mean, how much are, if you wanted to buy each of those games on the iPhone, what would that come to?
They're free.
they all have free versions? I know the original did. I didn't know if like Rio and stuff was
free
too.
I know Space does, but Space isn't even on the Space is actually, I think, kind of good. I don't think any of the other ones really are good, but Space actually introduces new concepts that are fun, but that is nowhere to be seen on this game.
No, it's only Rio Seasons and the original. I mean, they each game, I guess, has a lot of content in its own, right? Like, I probably put in 40, 50 minutes, and I'm only in the first of six areas, and not even halfway through that. So, there's a lot to do, but it's going to get old really quick, yeah. Because it's the same thing, yep. Just different level design.
And if it were on eShop, yeah. That would be another thing.
Yeah, if they released it on the eShop for $4, that's even a little bit more reasonable. But...
but anyway, you're playing more interesting stuff. You opened up a WoW account. I never knew that you ever really played World of Warcraft.
I played World of Warcraft probably about a year ago, and the new expansion came out. So of course I went and upgraded my account and resubscribed just for a month. I'm not gonna become one of those addicts.
Sure.
Yeah, we'll see.
Gonna put up that job posting for a news editor now, buddy.
But surprisingly, the new expansion is much better than I anticipated. Each time a new expansion came out, I always bought the upgrade and then just played it for a month or two. And then I was just done with it. But this one is more engrossing for sure.
How are the pandas?
They're panda-ish and definitely a highlight. but one of the main things I wanted to touch on was the questing in the game. For those that don't know, World of Warcraft, like, a new area is split up into different zones that have their own, like, little quest chains or something along those lines.
It's kind of like Xenoblade.
Yeah, kind of. That's a good comparison, actually. And where I like this expansion more than previous ones is that each zone feels like its own individual area where it's telling a story with persistent character interaction, where you're dealing with the same people at the start of the area through the end of the area. And then it's all contributing to this overall story for the whole expansion. Which they kinda did before in World of Warcraft, but not really. So, I'm really enjoying that. And this is kind of the Nintendo tie-in that I wanted to mention, is the Pokemon battles in World of Warcraft.
Yeah.
But it's just pet battling. You can collect little critters and pets, level them 1 through 25, and I think they get 6 moves total, and you can form a party of 3, and it's just basically Pokemon battles against
random people.
If you
like that, you should play Dragon Quest V.
and if you like that, you should play Pokemon.
Yeah. And that too, but Dragon Quest V is, it's a game that, like, you know, you have your party, but you also have all these creatures that will join your party. And it's kind of like Pokemon in that. I really dug that when I played it.
Well, see, WoW already outdoes Pokemon, because these critters, your pets can learn 6 moves at a time.
I know, that's incredible.
I think you can only use 3 moves at a time.
Oh, that's bullshit.
Oh,
yeah,
so
I think you can learn up to 6 moves, though.
Fuck WoW.
But, so in between battles, can you, like, alternate, like, switch moves out and, like,
See, I haven't messed with it that much. I've just done a few simple battles against, for instance, our programmer on the site, Dave, Scott, you've met him and
yes.
Talked with him.
We
be on this episode, actually,
yes,
with Dr.
A little Hume. Later. Yeah,
yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. I was doing some pet battling with him.
Did you kick his ass?
No, he destroyed me.
Well, he's yes. A programmer. He probably cheated somehow.
Fucking programmers, man.
But the one thing that is great is there's such a variety in the, like, different kinds of critters and pets that you can collect.
Cool.
Like, I was just flying around, and there's just so many different kinds.
And if you've already had a bunch of pets, because I know, like, throughout World of Warcraft, you've been able to collect pets and stuff. Like, you can use those pets, right?
Well, when I turned on my account, I went into my little pet journal, it was called, instead of, like, your Pokédex.
Real and subtle, Blizzard.
I already had, like, 20 in there, so it was quite nice.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. Not much else to say about World of Warcraft.
It's WoW.
If you've played it, you understand
that
it's addicting and good.
How many pandas have you made so far?
I didn't make any pandas. Wow. I'm just trying to level my Night Elf priest up to level 90.
What's the name of the panda in...
Pandarians?
No, in Kung Fu Panda. And have you seen a panda with that name yet?
Po, I think it was.
Yeah.
And have you seen a panda with that name
yet? I have not.
You know what's the really funny thing is how, like, everyone's complaining about, like, oh, just fucking Kung Fu Panda, why would they do this? It's like, but it's actually part of Warcraft lore.
Yeah,
like,
that's
stupid,
the argument
but it's
I always
legitimate.
Hear.
Are the pandas part of Warcraft lore?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. They've been around for a while.
From when? I mean, I've played a handful of Warcraft games. I don't remember no pandas.
Go fucking Google it, man. I don't play the Warcraft games much.
I mean, you know, I played Warcraft 2, 3, and the expansions to 3 and stuff, and I don't remember any pandas. But, I mean, I don't doubt what you're saying. I'm just saying, you know. It's just bad timing is all.
You asked about a reference to Kung Fu Panda. I didn't see that, but there are references to other things. Like, there was one quest I was doing where a guy got shot by an arrow, and he said to help him up, he took an arrow to the knee.
Oh, God.
If you know Skyrim.
That's a meme that can just go away.
There's also...
it wasn't really ever that funny to begin with.
Yeah. Just the fact that they include things
right.
like that.
What was the other one you were going to say?
It was an achievement.
Warcraft 3. That's where they're from.
Oh, is that one?
Really? Okay. I don't remember, but okay.
There was an achievement called I'm Pandaren and I, or whatever that song is, the LMFAO song.
Oh, like I'm Pandaren and I know it.
And I know it, yeah.
Not bad. Blizzard's usually pretty good about that. I mean, even like in their, like the strategy games like StarCraft and Warcraft and stuff, I mean, there's always those things where you can click the same character over and over and eventually it'll begin to say like funny things or like, yeah, reference pop culture and stuff. So they've always had those little like Easter eggs in there, I guess.
Well, I don't have much else to say on that. If you like WoW, go get WoW.
Is it enough? Like, do you think, like, if, say, someone's burnt out on WoW and they've moved on and it's been, like, 2 years since they played, is there enough new and, like, fresh content in there that they should come back?
I would definitely think so, yeah. There's a lot different. Like, they revamped the entire system of, like, attacking things. Everything's different. New talents and... I feel like a lot of this is just lingo for World of Warcraft.
Well, sure, yeah.
I don't want to ramble on too much into the specifics.
Is there still one more planned expansion to World of Warcraft? Do you know?
I don't know.
Okay.
They're probably going to do another.
For some reason, I thought there was another, but like at some point they have to move on, right? I mean, don't we know that moving on another, or they're working on another MMO? Like, they've announced that, right? They haven't said what it is or what franchise.
Like, World of Warcraft's been around for 8 years now,
yeah,
I think.
Which is crazy. I mean, it came out when I graduated high school.
I just read today as well, wow, that they're up over 10 million subscribers again.
I saw that.
Which is nuts. That many people still playing just boggles my mind.
When you buy the game, though, does it come with a free month?
No.
Oh, okay. So people actually had to resubscribe. Hmm.
Yeah.
But as far as I can tell, just doing my little dime store research, is that the pandas, the Pandarans or whatever, they were always kind of a joke, but they've been basically teased for years. Yeah. So, Patrick, you played Sonic Adventure 2?
Yeah, this is the HD remake on the PSN.
How's it look? Does it look like a modern-day game or a Dreamcast game?
It looks like, did you ever play the GameCube version of Sonic
Adventure
2?
Oh, yeah, it's probably based off of that.
Yeah, it looks a little bit better than
that. Well, see, Neil, that's a true question, because Dreamcast games already look like modern-day games.
Yeah.
Shit was ahead of its time.
Not really.
No, not at all.
I only downloaded the demo, so I only got to play one level, the City Escape level.
Oh, it's a great level!
I know.
Fucking love that level. Highlight of the game.
I didn't know what level it's gonna be. I played that level twice and I was done.
Like, do they have the option to like play any of the bullshit Knuckles levels?
Not in the demo.
I've beaten that game completely. I don't know what's wrong with me.
One thing I wanted to make sure was the Chao system. Do you remember? Yeah, I wanted to make sure that was still there and it is.
Yeah.
And it's really tempting for $10 on the PSN. It was just when I was playing it, something I played it on the GameCube. I never had the Dreamcast version.
I played the Dreamcast version, but I didn't own a Dreamcast until a couple years. Basically, I think I owned Sonic Adventure 2 on GameCube before I even owned a Dreamcast.
But something just felt strange about it. Like, I couldn't grasp the controls again. Like, I wasn't doing real well.
Because it's an old game.
Yeah, I guess that's what it was. It's just when Sonic Adventure 2 Battle was out, I was so good at those levels. Like, I was A ranking everything, and it's just, I scored E twice in a row.
I mean, I just remember with Sonic Adventure 2, like, it's such a dumb fucking game. Because the Sonic and Shadow levels are pretty much all legitimately fun. Like, I remember loving the crap out of those levels. And then, like, when your Tails or Robotnik, and you're just like a mech shooting things, like, okay, that's not as good, but it's still kind of fun. And then the Knuckles and the fucking Bat levels, like, they are terrible. I specifically remember
one of the Bat levels, you were in, like, a bank, and you were going through vaults or something. Like,
the pumpkin one, where there's Knuckles with the fucking rap. Like, I had that, like, I should listen to it because I want to remember what it is, but I just had it stuck in my head for days afterwards, like some kind of fucking Stockholm syndrome, just being like, stupid pumpkin level, pumpkin hills or whatever. Like, there were a lot of good things I thought about Sonic Adventure 2, but just on the whole, there was so much bullshit that, like, why? It's like with Resident Evil 6, how, like, it's a game where they're like, we made 4 campaigns that are all 8 to 10 hours long, but the game fucking sucks. Like, and it looks like Sega kind of learned the lesson, because I think that's what Generations was like, where it was just kind of like fucking Sonic levels. That's the game. Because I kept on being concerned about, like, well, we can't have them be short. It's like, I don't care if it's short. Just make it good.
You know, when you said Resident Evil 6, I wanted to bring up, too, there was one other thing that irked me. There's 3 different buttons you use to pick up things off the ground, like ammo, to open doors, or to open doors with your partner. So square opens, or picks up items, X opens doors, and then circle opens doors with your partner.
That's
and
ridiculous.
It's the stupidest thing I've ever seen in my entire life. I just had to throw that in there.
Well, I'm gonna talk about a Sega game that is really, really good. Hell yeah, Wrath of the Dead Rabbit. It's a game from Arcado Studio. They made Big Bang Mini on the DS and some Xbox Live indie games that I'd never played. But what this game is, it's sort of like Drill Dozer, it's sort of a Metroidvania, but it's just this gorgeous 2D side-scrolling game where you're the Prince of Hell, named Ash, and you have, like, a chainsaw jetpack around you, and the plot of it is that you're the Prince of Hell, and you have a fetish for rubber duckies. Some monster comes in and snaps a picture of you in the bathtub with a rubber ducky, and then everyone calls you a pussy. So, being the Prince of Hell, your idea is like, well, 100 people saw that on the internet before it got taken down. I've got to kill all those motherfuckers. So, that's the game. You're just going through these different zones and areas, looking for monsters to kill them. And when you kill them, like, usually, sometimes it's just like, you know, you basically just happen upon a guy and you fucking chainsaw him to death. And sometimes it's like a fuller boss battle. But when you have them down to the end of their health, there will be like a WarioWare game will come up where it's like one of them might be, time the button press so the thing, like the arrow that's moving is in the green. Or, there's stuff where it's just like, there's like random quizzes that show up and all this other shit. It's just really, really weird and esoteric sometimes, but it's just a lot of fun. And it is a game that kind of relies on that little bit of like two-stick navigation shit too. Well, not navigation, but just like the way you use your weapons is kind of weird because you always use the right stick to kind of guide it and you use the trigger buttons to kind of like use what weapon you're using. So, like, you'll, have the chainsaw around your jetpack that's around you. So you have the circular blade around you, and you use that by holding an X trigger button and using the right stick in one direction. And then if you hit another trigger button, then it's basically like a twin-stick shooter, and you have guns to fire. It's a little weird, but, I mean, it's kind of incredible, because it varies it up a lot. There was a spot where I was in a ship in space. I was underwater in a submarine. And I'm probably about halfway through it. I think I've killed about 50 of the 100 monsters, and it's just a ton of fun.
I'm not sure if you mentioned this before, but just to clarify, is this on the PlayStation Store?
Yeah, this is on XBLA, PlayStation, and it came out on Steam this week. It's cheaper with PlayStation Plus, Patrick. You save $4. I don't know how long the discount's going, but it's really, really good. And I was torn between that and Tokyo Jungle, and I picked this and I've come to the conclusion that I don't want Tokyo Jungle. Because I heard too many people go, like, it's just like Dead Rising. I'm like, well, I don't really like that game. So, well, yeah, not that you, it's just like Dead Rising.
You get to raise, like, an army of beagles and just, like,
I mean,
kill
that
lions
is cool,
and stuff.
But I'm,
in Tokyo,
I mean, it's like a roguelike, and it has a lot of that, like, you're going to die a lot and then restart and do the same thing over and over again, and maybe with a different animal. And that doesn't appeal to me as much, despite the fact that the idea is so, so awesome.
It's so great. I love the that you have to mate in order to, like, continue
playing and,
the
like,
game.
You see the animals mount each other.
Yeah, that's great.
Like, there's a lot about that game that, like, I think I would, like, get drunk and laugh at it, but I as, like, someone who doesn't have as much time to play games...
Yeah.
Or at least especially, like, games in my free time, like, I'll choose Hell Yeah over Tokyo Jungle. I really, really like Hell Yeah. It just, I mean, it's a 2D platformer, and there's just a lot of insanity about it. I highly recommend it to anybody.
You may have sold me on this.
To anybody who likes 2D platformers that are crazy as shit. Yeah, I mean, it's definitely, like, you know, there's some issues with it. There's some, like, ridiculous checkpoints. Like, you know, you could kill... Well, I think it usually... Even if you die and have to, like, cover a lot of ground, if you killed any monsters, that saves. But you still have to, like, go through all these different obstacles sometimes. But, I mean, I haven't really run into that issue too much. Although, like I said, I'm only halfway through the game. I guess we're running a little long. So, I might just mention that I'm playing the Dempamen as well. And Nate Andrews is working on the review. And I believe me, him, and Tyler are going to record a segment on that soon, so I'll save my thoughts for that. But to kind of summarize, the Dempamen is like Dragon Quest Lite, and I don't know if I'd really say it's that good, but I have a lot of fun playing it. Did either of you guys play the demo?
I tried the demo, and I did like maybe two fights down in the one dungeon. I'd collected three Dempamen. Did two fights, and I was just turned off by it. The fights just didn't interest me.
It's really, like, difficult when you first start off, and then once you collect more Dempamen, and eventually, like, probably within, like, the second hour, you have eight guys in your party. And when you have that, it opens the game up a lot more. But if you didn't, like, I mean, I kind of enjoyed the demo, so that's why I went for the full game.
But I just don't understand why, when you're fighting in the dungeon, there was just, like, one move. I just, like, would click auto-attack or something.
Oh, if you go down, you can select them individually. But I actually found that the auto-attack is, I mean, it's the kind of thing where it just kind of simplifies the act of those, you know, kind of basic dungeon-crawling RPGs, like a Dragon Quest, where instead of having to, you know, go through every standard battle and select everyone's move, you just hit auto and watch it go, and it usually works. And then when you want to fine-tune it, you can. It's a TV-watching game for me.
Okay.
Well, I haven't put the demo, but I kind of prefer that because that means I just have no fucking idea what Patrick means when he says he did two fights in a dungeon and collected three Dempamen. I just like to have no idea what that could possibly mean. So that's just me.
Yeah. So the last thing that I'm going to talk about is the new Super Mario Bros. 2 DLC, which finally hit North America after coming out in Europe and Japan earlier in the week. I got all three level packs, and I think on the whole, it's all really cool. I think the idea of DLC for New Super Mario Bros. 2 is awesome, and it makes Coin Rush even better, and I was already having a lot of fun with Coin Rush. What it does is basically, instead of giving you, like, random levels, you, in addition to, like, the mushroom, the flower, and the star pack, you can get, you know, anywhere from 1 to 3 new packs, which, 3 levels, same every time. The first one is the Gold Rush pack, where there's just a fuck ton of coins. Like, with minimal effort, you can get the 3,000 max coins that you can get, like, total. Well, I guess there's 30,000. It's 30,000, I think. But, I mean, it's just a lot of fun kind of having this easy level where the goal is not necessarily to, you know, just survive or anything. It's just like, all right, how many freaking coins can I get out of this level this time? And there's a lot of hidden areas, and I had a lot of fun with it. The second one, the coin challenge one that has online leaderboards that I haven't really checked out yet, isn't really too interesting. It's kind of just standard fare, not really too super into that one. And the third one, I almost got to the end, but it's the Nerve Rack pack, and it's hard as shit, but it's so much fun.
That's the one that interested me the most.
Well, what I actually did with it was because I couldn't beat the first level, and I was just like, I just want to see what the other levels are. So I did, I played it as, like, the white raccoon Mario. So, you know, you're invincible. But the problem with that is the second and third levels in that kind of rely on you to bounce off of Koopa Troopa's heads to stay up. And when you are that white raccoon, you just kill them instantly and go right through them.
That's a weird oversight.
Yeah, I was not able to beat the third level with the invincible raccoon, but at least I got to see all three levels. I was just kind of curious to see what they all looked like. And now I'll go back to, you know, slamming my head against the wall with the first one. But it really is, it's super challenging and it's a lot of fun. But the one issue with it is that I know Danny in his impressions mentioned Super Meat Boy level difficulty. But the key thing about Super Meat Boy and a lot of those really hard, like, platformers, like Bitrup Runner, etc., is that there is really a minimal delay from when you die and when you start again. The problem with the Coin Rush stuff is when you die, you have to start the entire thing over again. So does that make it really rewarding when you hopefully eventually beat all three levels? Oh, yes, of course. But until you do, it fucking sucks. Because that first level is already very hard, and I can tell you, if I legitimately beat that and get to the second level and die halfway through that, I'll just be angry. Like, but I mean, I think it's really cool, and I look forward to seeing more levels come out of this, because it seems like, you know, I mean, well, the way I'm looking at it is that two out of three ain't bad. One of them's kind of forgettable, but if two of them are really fun, then if they're going to keep on releasing sets of three packs and two of them are good and one of them isn't, that's awesome. That's a good percentage.
Yeah, I'd say so.
Are any of you guys interested in the DLC?
I'll probably pick up probably the first and last pack.
Yeah, that's what I would recommend. Unless the online leaderboard stuff gets interesting, which I kind of doubt.
Yeah. Like, for me, I have yet to get a street pass for New Super Mario Bros. 2, so I'm not really into the Coin Rush probably as much as you are.
Yeah,
I'm sure you've
got that. Yeah, that helped a lot. I've been living off of the fatted calf that I got at the Wii U event.
Yeah. Those are all. I've gotten a few street passes with Coin Rush stuff, and it is actually a lot of fun. I mean, it gives you someone to compete against. You know, it's great. Even if you don't know that person, it's kind of...
Although
without that incentive, I just have no reason to endlessly do it.
Right. Well, you got to get those million coins.
Yep.
Can we just spoil it? I haven't looked it up, but Neil, you probably know. What's the reward for getting the million? Just tell
me. You really want to know?
Just tell me. I'm going to just... If you don't tell me now, I'm just going to look on GameFAQs after we're done.
It is so dumb. You want
That's
to know
what I heard. That's what I heard.
The fucking main screen changes.
That's it?
That is it.
What does it change to?
It's just like all gold, and there's like maybe a statue of Mario or something.
Fuck you, Nintendo.
I remember, like, there was all the speculation, like, maybe you'll unlock another character that you can play as. And I'm just like, oh, that'd be cool. And then someone got to it, and I looked it up, and I'm like, you're fucking kidding me. Really? I might get it. Like, especially just playing these, I think I went up 50,000 coins in, like, 15 minutes.
Yeah,
not even.
I heard on Twitter that with these level packs, I mean, you're pretty much guaranteed to get a million if you play them consistently. Like, you get a ton of coins.
Well, yeah, I mean,
I think the first level pack gives you on average about 30,000.
Well,
each
30,000 is like, that's the limit for all the levels. So basically, like, if you do it decently, you'll get 30,000 coins. I mean, that's a big reason why, you know. Well, I think it's actually, I think I've gained more than, I think I was at like 175 and now I'm past 250.
Yeah, that's just crazy. I mean, the whole conceit of the game is to collect a crazy amount of coins. In the beginning, it says, try to collect a million. And then it's like, look, we changed the splash screen at the front. Hooray.
You know what, guys? I mean, that shit worked on Mario Kart 64, but it's not going to work in 2012. Fuck off.
I love that with Mario Kart 64. Even in the first Mario Party, the menu screen would change depending who won the last round.
Well, I mean, it's also the kind of thing where, like, that's a game that you play with other people, so you can be like, hey, man, look at how big my Nintendo 64-shaped dick is. Look at that. I got the alternate title screen of Mario Kart 64. It's with New Super Mario Bros. 2, you're like, I finally got it. You look around, you're alone. Shit.
There's beer bottles and ramen, empty ramen packages everywhere.
I'm going to take a picture of this and post it on Twitter. And you post it on Twitter, and someone's like, man, fucking A, I didn't get it yet. Why'd you post it?
Yeah, all you get is shit. No retweets, no favorites, just shit.
No one's like, good job. Everyone's just like, fuck you. Get a life, hippie.
God. How sweet was that alternate menu screen in Mario Kart, though? It was like the sun was setting, right?
It was like a nice like, orange backdrop. Yeah. Like, I mean, it is the kind of thing... I do feel a little ridiculous that, like, I look back at that. I'm like, oh, that was so cool. And I think, like, was there anything else unlockable in Mario Kart 64? No.
Oh, yeah.
And then, like, I'm looking at this with a million coins. I'm like, this is fucking bullshit. Where I probably put more work into Mario Kart 64.
Yeah. Well, Mario Kart 64, you could unlock, like, the track, like, the mirror tracks and stuff like that, I guess. But, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm digging the new Super Mario Bros. 2 DLC. I think it's a good idea. I almost played the Style Savvy demo for this purpose. I'm probably still going to play it at Red Impressions, but I'll wait until the second demo comes out, which will be after the game comes out. But let's face it, unless we convince Carmine to come on here, no one's going to fucking talk about Style Savvy.
Absolutely. Do we know how many DLC packs are doing for New Super Mario Bros.?
There's another one in November and another one in December, I think. Or it might be the end of October and December. I don't know if it's done after that, but that's okay. What they've announced.
That's what
is that there are two more coming this year.
Hmm.
Kind of... Do you think they're going to bring DLC to New Super Mario Bros. U?
I don't know.
Like, they're doing it with this, so why wouldn't they?
I know with Nintendo Land, I think they put the kibosh on DLC, but with New Super Mario Bros. U, I guess it's totally possible. I would assume that the hooks will be in for New Super Mario Bros. U. I would hope so, but I don't know if we'll see it announced right away.
Yeah. I mean, if they did it for this for Coin Rush, I mean, I guess they could do it for, what, Boost Rush mode or whatever.
Yeah, but Coin Rush is actually fun.
Yeah, that's true. That's
Boost Rush, I mean, it's like maybe I shouldn't just judge it from when I played at the event, but playing Boost Rush at that Wii U event the other week pretty much zapped all of my interest in New Super Mario Bros. U. Like, it's the kind of thing I was talking about with a friend of mine where I was just like, you know what, when that game comes out, you know, I'm still going to be excited. Don't get me wrong. But right now, it's just like, I look forward to the Wii U, and I'm just like, Nintendo Land looks really fun. Someone mentions Mario, I'm like, nope, not going to do it for me right now. Because it's just, there's so many good things about that game, but just my last experience, but it was so just bleh.
Neil, if there was anything to kind of base your opinion of not liking it off of, it would be playing it.
Yeah.
don't say, I don't know if I should not like it. I mean, all I did was play it. I mean, that's a pretty good basis to make your opinion from.
The only time I really enjoyed playing that game, and I played it, there was like the Wii U experience in New York. There was E3, and there was the Wii U preview event. Didn't really enjoy it at the Wii U preview event. Didn't really like it that much at E3. I do love the flying squirrel suit, though. That is fantastic.
Yeah, it looks pretty sweet.
The only time I enjoyed it when I was playing with two of my friends and we just griefed the shit out of each other.
Yeah.
So I think that's just what I'm going to do when I get the game. It's just either play it by myself or just be like, hey guys, come over. Someone's going to use the Wii U gamepad and try to place the blocks and kill everyone. It's going to be awesome.
What you're going to do is bring over all the children in your family and just you control the gamepad and just kill them.
Yeah. I'll just be like, hey, nieces, want to come over and play some Mario? Yeah. You're gonna die.
I've decided that my mission between now and when the Wii U actually launches is to get everyone to believe that you already have the Wii U, as we almost had happen on Twitter today with Mike. So, like, that's my super goal.
It's like, I reread what I wrote being like, did I make it seem that way?
Not at all, but that's what he read it as. So that's my goal. I'm hoping by, like, the end of October, everyone can just already be believing that you've been playing the Wii U for like 3.5 weeks. And you're a total dick.
I'm going to look forward to you like tweeting at me, just being like, yeah, man, how's Nintendo Land?
Yeah. Yo, you ever get past World 2 Level 3 on Mario Wii U, or what's up?
So did you finish Zombie U yet?
Yeah.
Yeah, man, so how's Black Ops 2? I heard you've been playing that.
Yeah, so what's that like on the touchscreen? Does that work pretty well, or...? What's the multiplayer like? Yeah, that's my goal. So.
Yeah, anyway, there's cool stuff coming out soon, but bye.
All right, and that will do it for episode 54 of Connectivity. As always, you can send us listener mail to connectivity@nintendoworldreport.com. If you get a chance to rate and review us on iTunes, that would be awesome. And you should follow all of us on Twitter. Go to nintendoworldreport.com, look for the Twitter sidebar, and you can find all of our usernames there. As a reminder, the Doctor Who talk is next, and there are spoilers, like right away, so if you don't want to be spoiled, turn the show off now. Other than that, we'll see you next week.
It's a survivor. Very weak, but keep your eyes on it.
Where's Rory?
I'm sorry. Amelia. I'm so sorry.
No, we can just go and get him in the TARDIS. One more paradox.
Would rip New York apart.
Well, that's not true. I don't believe you.
Mother, it's true.
Amy, what are you doing?
That gravestone, Rory's. There's room for one more name, isn't there?
What are you talking about?
Back away from the angel. Come back to the TARDIS. We'll figure something out.
The angel, would it send me back to the same time to him?
I don't know. Nobody knows.
But it's my best shot, yeah?
No!
Doctor, shut up! Yes, it is!
Amy!
Well, then, I just have to blink, right?
No!
It'll be fine. I know it will. I'll be with him, like I should be. Me and Rory together. Melody.
Stop it! Just stop it!
You look after him. And you be a good girl and you look after him.
You are creating fixed time. I will never be able to see you again.
I'll be fine. I'll be with him.
Amy, please. Just come back into the TARDIS. Come along, Tom, please.
Raggedy Man! Goodbye!
Hello, everyone, and that's right, we're back with another Doctor Who bonus segment. Today I'm joined by Patrick.
And yes, that was a sonic screwdriver.
Perfect. And David.
Hello.
Hello. First time, I think, officially on the podcast. I guess you did do one of our recent best of segments.
Yes, I was on the Smash Brothers Brawl
segment. Oh, okay. There you go. Wait, were you, I edited that one. Were you really?
Yeah, okay.
I guess I remember that. Yeah, okay. I do remember that. That's weird.
Scott's been doing so much editing.
I've been doing so many of them. They do. They blur together. I just slap them in there, and I just edit out all the sneezes and then throw it up on the website. if everything went according to plan, as this intro, you heard Amy's like final in-person speech to the Doctor. And we'll be talking about that in a minute, but we figured we should probably start first with The Power of Three, the penultimate episode for this sort of half season. What'd you guys think about it?
It was better than the weeks before, I think. Like, you and I talked about this the last Doctor Who bonus segment, and I wasn't going into it expecting too much because I thought it was going to be one of those episodes that didn't focus on the Doctor and just kind of focus more on the pawns, which it did, but it also had a focus on the Doctor, and it was good. And the Nintendo Wii was featured, and that was pretty great.
Which was great. That's right. I'll need to put that somewhere in here, too, yeah, because that's so perfect.
Oh, that's second set, Doctor!
Oh, if Dread Perry could see me now, eh? He'd probably ask for his shorts back.
And now we have the loosest, flimsiest connection to, like, Doctor Who and connectivity that we can talk about it.
There's a reason we exist
here. The Wii was in it. I was really hoping, like, I mean, I know they'd have to pay money to Nintendo so they didn't do this, but I was really hoping we'd see, like, the Doctor's me and that he would somehow have a bow tie on it. Like, they'll be like, how'd you get a bow tie on it? And it's like, well, because I'm the Doctor. Like, that's what I do. I just...
Couldn't you do something fancy with... I always see those Miis where they...
I know. You could, like, move the mouth really low or something. Yeah. Or, yeah, put eyebrows, like, on the chin or something. Yeah, I mean, that's true. But, oh, well. David, what'd you think about the episode?
You know, it was pretty good, but overall it didn't do anything for me. I mean, it was focused on the pawns a little bit, and I did totally miss that Wii, so I'm gonna have to go rewatch it.
But, oh, really?
Yeah, I don't know what happened there.
But, well, you don't explicitly see the Wii, but because I was watching with my girlfriend, and like watching Doctor Who, there's always like a 15% chance I'm not going to understand something just because they talk so quickly and I don't always grasp the British accent. So like Amy like was telling either Rory or Rory's dad or someone that like the Doctor was playing the Wii, and I was like, I turned to my girlfriend, I was like, did she say Wii? And then like it cuts to him, and yeah, he's got like, you don't see the Wii remote, but he's got like a tennis like racket like add-on on top of it, and he's just like, he's playing it, but it has the sound effects and stuff.
Yeah, actually, now that you mention it, I do remember him playing tennis and thinking, was that a Wii? But I totally missed the comment about that.
Yeah, I guess that's true. If you missed Amy's comment, then you wouldn't have any idea.
Right, like it looks like maybe he could be playing a knockoff or something, but yeah, she explicitly says Wii, which I thought was great, so. Yeah. Well, I do agree, I don't know, I'm kind of like 50-50 on this episode. I really enjoy like the character stuff. I enjoyed seeing what the pawns do when they're not with the Doctor, their lives, and how they're trying to balance both lives. And then just seeing how the Doctor was going crazy by having to sit around and wait with them this whole year while these cubes that fell from space finally did something.
Yeah.
which I guess we should say, cubes fell from space. They didn't do anything. Everyone kind of forgot about them over the next year, and then finally they basically gave everyone heart attacks and like killed a bunch of people. But then the Doctor reversed it and brought all the people back to life.
Which didn't make quite a lot of sense.
No,
if your heart was stopped for 10 minutes or so.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like he was there when it happened, then he flipped the switch and it went right back. Yeah, I mean, these people are lying dead in the street for at least 10 minutes. Yeah, that's not good for your brain there, I don't think.
Well, I mean, it was really slow build-up, in my opinion, and then it was just like, here, heart attacks, and then he reverses it, and I mean, you know, I guess that's what makes a Doctor Who episode issue, you know, there's a problem, and then the Doctor fixes it, but it was a really slow build-up, there wasn't much action, and it, you know, it just wasn't my favorite of the season so far.
No, but definitely not. I enjoy
Think the slow build-up was intentional because they were focusing more on the pawns on purpose because this is their, like, right near their swan song.
And, like, I'm good with that, like, a good slow build-up. But, yeah, there just wasn't much payoff in terms of the actual cubes themselves. I was thinking about this as I was driving home today to, like, talk about this episode. And I think the problem is Doctor Who can't ever really do just, like, a character-centric episode. Whereas, like, a show, like, maybe in the similar vein, like, something like Lost or Battlestar Galactica, like, they could have a whole episode where there's really no action. It's all about, like, a character resolving some issue or just exploring a character's background. And with Doctor Who, you don't get that. Like, every episode kind of needs to stand on its own. So while we did have a lot of character stuff, there always has to be this sort of, like, science fiction, like, story to go along with it. You know, there has to be something that happens. And I think that's kind of to the show's detriment. At least lately, where I think they're trying to get more and more character focused, you know, having to kind of string in these little stories that are honestly the worst part of the episode. I mean, I think if they had just taken it out, it would have been a lot better. You know, I could watch a whole episode with the pawns, like, just living their lives and the Doctor going crazy, being there with them and, you know, and that kind of stuff. I didn't need all of a sudden they go to space and there's a guy who's decided he wants to kill a bunch of humans, and then the Doctor saves the day. You know, that was like 5 minutes of the episode, and it could have just not been there, and I would have been happy. I mean, what do you guys think about that? Like, I really think it's kind of an issue they not need to address necessarily, but I think they need to balance it out better where the character stuff matches the quality of the actual storyline of that individual episode.
You do notice that, like, each season so far, I think there's been, like, that one character-centric episode where, like, last season it was the girl who waited where Amy was kind of stranded for 20 years or so, I think.
Yeah.
And that was just really slow, and it just dealt with Amy and Rory's relationship. Season 5, I can't remember. There was probably one, I just don't remember it off the top of my head, but those episodes, they're just slower moving, slower paced, and there's not a lot of action, and I just takes away from, like, the flow of the season in general. Especially last season, where it was that steady build-up of action over time.
Yeah.
And then that episode, I thought, just brought it down.
That's the one where she gets really old, right? She
is like,
okay.
But, I mean, it kept your heart racing a little. Like, you know, are they gonna find Amy, you know, the young Amy and the old Amy? And the one with the cubes, it was like there was just nothing but dialogue. until the last, like, 5-10 minutes, and then the cube started doing stuff, and then they gave people heart attacks, and then the doctor reversed it. You know, it was just, the quality of the action wasn't that great. Like, they could have had the cubes do so much more. I mean, it did feel like it was more on the order of a suspenseful episode, but I don't know, Doctor Who doesn't seem to do just suspense. It seems more suspenseful action.
They need to mix suspense and action and character building into one cohesive episode, and I guess that's what they probably have trouble with right now.
Right, yeah. Or like,
if that's what you're saying, Scott.
Yeah. Or I think even just not be afraid to have an episode that's just like character focused. You know, it's just they're in this place where each episode needs to stand alone and tell a little story. But when you have these characters that exist from episode to episode, I mean, I don't think there's any reason to, you know, be afraid to just explore those characters in an episode.
Now
you know, it doesn't always have to be tied to some like interstellar threat.
Characters like going back quite a ways, Donna and Martha, where they were just around for one season. Mm-hmm. I think there you can get away with, you don't need a character-centric episode. But with the Ponds, 2.5 seasons, they needed that one, I guess.
And when you know that this is their second to last episode, I mean, everyone knew it.
Yeah.
So I appreciate what they did do for the Ponds, but yeah, it just, then when you throw in this extra, like, story that just wraps up in 10 minutes, you know, I think it just takes away from the episode as a whole. You know, they could have just not had that there. And I think the episode would have been fine.
It seemed a little late as well. I mean, it's the episode before that they leave the doctor, and now they're finally explaining what their home life's about. I know that season 5, it all took place before, you know, between the night before Amy gets married and the day she gets married. So, you know, there really wasn't much going on, but season 6, you know, you don't know what, well, I guess they were with the doctor the whole time. Like, it just didn't touch upon it.
Yeah. Well, and I think this is the first time, at least in the new, like, series reboot, that the companions haven't just always been with the doctor. I mean, as far as I can tell, like, Rose and Donna and Martha, that their entire seasons, they were always with the doctor. But here you have Amy and Rory who do go back home and aren't always with him.
Yeah. Especially in this season, all these episodes seem to have, like, months in between.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And, like, a few of them open with the doctor, like, picking them up.
Yeah.
You know? Like, they're just not there. So, I don't know. It was good to see their lives. But one thing as we wrap this up and move into the final episode that I thought was interesting is I thought this episode was going to end with them saying, like, okay, we need to tell the doctor we're done. Like, you know, whatever we're going to do, you know, and I thought it would kind of link to this week, the finale. Like, I thought he was gonna say, okay, this is our last going out with him, and then we need to tell him that we're done, we're gonna stay home. But in the end they actually resolve, like, okay, let's just travel with the doctor forever.
which
is so weird, because in the next episode they can't do that anymore.
It's definitely strange, because you know they're leaving in one episode, and they make that major decision to not leave him, so you're just like, well, something clearly bad is going to happen.
Yeah, I thought for sure it was going to be, okay, like, this is it, and then after this, we're telling him we're done, and then, of course, their last journey out with him, something horrible happens, but no, it's like, let's just be best friends for the rest of our lives. But okay, well, that's enough with that one. Let's move on to The Angels Take Manhattan, the more interesting of the two. It opens up great, I thought. This whole, like, noir opening with the detective narrating in, you think writing his story. Of course, it turns out to be River writing the story. But, you know, just his narration and his demeanor and everything. It was very, I don't know, kind of an interesting take on, like, 1930s or 40s.
I think it was 30s, yeah. 30s,
yeah, like America and stuff from this British perspective. I thought it was really cool. I thought it was really well done and got me excited to watch the episode. I mean, what did you guys think about that?
I mean, it was certainly different for Doctor Who. It was a much more lengthy opening, I thought, compared to
all the
ones that they've done recently. And I guess this is a spoiler-ish episode, but the Statue of Liberty right there at the end was very cool.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I thought so, too. Yeah, with those, like, crazy just teeth and everything. Yeah.
Like I kind of saw it coming, because, like, what else?
They showed a shot of it. Yeah, and they showed a shot of it, like, as he was going into that like, hotel or whatever.
Yeah.
And I kind of thought, like, oh, my God, are they really going to do that? And they did.
You know, I was at home, and I realized that we do get BBC America here. And Patrick had invited me over to watch it with him and his family. And, you know, I was like, I'm just going to watch the intro. And it was so good that I had to pry myself away from the television, you know, to prevent myself from watching the entire episode just then. And
because, well, what do you do? Why, Patrick, do you watch it the next day or something? Like, how do you watch it?
No, I work, and Dave comes over like 11 o'clock-ish. And then
So you guys were just going to watch it later that night. Yeah. Okay. All right. Yeah, keep going, Dave. Sorry.
Oh, no, that's fine. And, you know, the anticipation between, what is it, air? 8 o'clock, if I remember correctly? The 3 hours there nearly killed me because I couldn't look at any spoilers. I couldn't think about it. You know, I couldn't turn on the TV. You know, I was just dying inside my head to find out.
Yeah. Well, like for me, I've talked about it before, but I download the episodes on PS3, because I can't stand watching it on standard def on BBC America. So I wait till the next day to watch it anyway, but just like scanning through Twitter that night after the episode aired and just hearing everyone like talk about how like sad it was and just all these different things. Like it kept getting me so excited. Well, I mean, I almost wanted to watch it in standard def, but I thought, no.
I always have that problem too. Like, I have to pull myself away from the computer because it airs in the UK like 3 o'clock Eastern. Some of my friends, they had watched it like a live stream from the UK version.
Oh, wow.
And I was just like, well, I can't sit here anymore and talk to you.
Yeah.
Because this will kill me on the inside.
Yeah. But yeah, I thought that was one of the best openings that doesn't involve the Doctor. I mean, there's been many where it's like a side character or someone dies to kind of set the tone. And I thought this is one of the best. Just the whole environment and like Patrick said, just something new for Doctor Who, this whole like noir theme, I thought was really well done. And yeah, it got me super excited. So the intro plays, of course, and then the Doctor and Rory and Amy are in New York in present day, and they're just in the park, and the Doctor's reading aloud, as apparently he can't read in his head. And they're just having a nice day on the park there. And you get some interesting things that kind of, you know, like, forebode for what's going to happen. Like, Amy's wearing glasses now because she's getting a little bit older, and the Doctor notices, like, eyes on her lines on her eyes and things like that, and, you know, sees her, like, aging and is, like, kind of befuddled by it. And then, you know, you see him rip out the last page of the book, and he says, you know, I hate endings. I don't read the last page of a book because I don't want a story to end. Maybe a little heavy-handed, but still, you know, it just adds a little bit more to his character.
This episode was full of foreshadowing.
Yes. Oh yeah, for sure. So Rory goes to get coffee, and then on the way back, we see some angels tailing him, the Weeping Angels, and then suddenly he is in the 30s where the episode opened, and River's in front of him. And then it turns out the book that the Doctor's been reading is written by River, and she's sort of detailing the events of what's going on concurrently, which if you think too hard about it, like, makes your head hurt. So it's just best not to, like, think about, like, how they're happening at the same time. But,
well, I mean, take a look at Blink. I mean, the other Weeping Angels episode, you know, there were the DVDs, and to think that, you know, the Doctor had this script that he got, but he didn't know it was going to happen, and then it happened, but they had already written this, you know, it was, yeah. It's happening, like, it just, you know, I love time travel episodes and shows, because it makes you think, and it just, it, you know, you have to think, it's abstract, and I like that.
Yeah, and for a show about time travel, like, at its core, there aren't many episodes where it, like, really comes into play like this. I mean, for the most part, it just puts them in a new setting. There's only been a handful of episodes, I think, where, like, there's two timelines going on, like, concurrently, and you're interacting between the two. Like Blink, for instance. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, so then, you know, it turns out with all the Weeping Angels, there's sort of, like, some time disturbances. The Doctor can't land exactly in the 30s, so he has to get, as he calls them, landing lights, a signal to lock onto. So he goes back to, like,
present 2012.
Well, first he goes back to 2012. Yeah, he bounces off the 30s, and then he goes back to the what dynasty was it in China?
Oh, that's right. I'm not sure.
I can't remember. Well, one dynasty in China, because the guy in the 30s is a big collector of like pottery and art from that era. And so the doctor goes there and like writes like a code word yowza onto like a pot, and then so when River sees it, she's able to like use that to like pinpoint her coordinates, and then the doctor can lock onto it. It's all kind of weird, but I guess it works.
Well, they've so done the, stuff like that before, where they send a message from the past to someone in the future. I think.
Right? Yeah.
Like Blink.
Yeah. Exactly.
What's the episode where they go back to the first written word and it says "Hello, sweetie," if I'm not mistaken, and it was River that went back to write it to give him a message.
Doesn't she like breaks into a place, right? She like, and she's getting chased by a bunch of guards.
I think that's the season 5 finale, right?
I think so.
Yeah. Quite possibly, yeah. It's been a little while.
Yeah, I know. I need to rewatch all the Matt. I've seen the David Tennant stuff like 2 times through now. I need to rewatch the Matt Smith stuff. So they're all reunited in the 30s, and I think this is where like stuff kind of starts to get interesting and really begins to like suggest that things aren't going as planned. Before they even get there, Amy reads ahead in the book and reads a line that why do you have to break mine? And the doctor kind of freaks out when she reads that and says, well, now that you've read it, like it has to happen. It's a fixed point. Like there's no way in avoiding it. So when the doctor gets there, Angel has grabbed River's wrist and won't let go. And so now he has to break her wrist because he's read in the book that there's like nothing he can do. He has to break her wrist to get her hand out of there. I don't know why he's tied to that. I guess not doing it would create a paradox, which might be bad, although they end up deciding to do it anyway at the end to get away from the angels. But and then you just get a lot of moments where he just seems unhinged. So when River ends up having to break her own wrist to get her arm out of there, and he sees that there was no avoiding that, her wrist was still broken, he gets upset, but then he heals her broken wrist with his regeneration energy, and she slaps him, and then Amy says, like, to stick to science, to stop trying to, you know, do too much, and they both storm out, and then he, like, slams his feet, like, in frustration and stuff, and I just thought it was a cool scene, like, to see him that overwhelmed.
You have to realize he's also dealing with the anger at that point that he knows it's Amy's kind of last adventure, because the last chapter of the book
he saw the title. You're right.
Well.
Yeah, he sees the title of the book and chapter.
The fact that River had to break her arm, he knows there's no way escaping it.
I know. He had that moment where she was hiding it, that she broke her wrist, and he was very excited that, like, okay, well, like, maybe we can actually get around this. But then when he sees the wrist broken, he sort of comes down again and gets very depressed. In this time now, Rory's been transported to the same hotel that we saw in the opening with the detective, and is kind of wandering the halls in the same way. And Doctor and River and Amy show up, and they all walk into the room together, and there's old Rory, who is now aged and dies in that bed. And that's when the doctor kind of explains that, well, the angels are sort of harvesting people. They take them back, and then they lock them in this hotel and just kind of feed off of that time energy until the person dies. And then I would assume can just repeat it again and again and again, because the person dies as their younger self sees them. So then they just take the younger self back in time and just keep repeating it. Is kind of how I took that. I mean, is that what you guys thought? I mean, that's...
Oh, also, every time they try to escape the hotel, they just throw them back in time again.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, there's no escaping.
I mean,
which also feeds them the energy.
The thing that I don't get is if Rory goes there and they send him back, where... Do they just keep sending him back, like, you know, 2 days... and just keeping him in that room? Or do they just send them back once, let them live out their lives in that room?
The way I took it is they send them back once, like a good chunk of time, you know, like whatever, 40, 50 years, and then let them live out their lives in that room, and then when they die, it's the exact moment that their younger self, you know, is coming into that room, so then they grab the younger self and then just send them back again, and it's like this loop where they just keep sending them back, you know, that 40 or 50 years, letting them live, die, and then doing it again. But you're right, it wasn't 100% clear.
but then you've got
when
old
is
Rory
anything in Doctor Who.
Yeah, you've got old Rory and young Rory, just using him for an example. Now the old Rory's already taken that room, so the young Rory comes in. Now they send young Rory back. Now there are 2 younger Rorys?
I see what you're saying. Or, like, every time they do it, is there another Rory? I mean, I guess maybe they just put him in a new room in the hotel.
But now, technically, he never existed for them to have taken him back to begin with, so he would have found himself.
Yeah, this is one of those instances where it's like best not to think too hard about the time travel aspect. Yeah, it's sort of like a little bit of a plot hole there, I guess. Yeah, it wasn't clear to me what the what they were exactly doing. I mean, you see he's aged, he's dying, he's an old man, but you're right. I mean, are they just sending him back another day, like every day or every couple days to kind of just get a little energy? Do they send him all the way back and then, yeah, I mean, like what's the...
Even if they're just sending him back a day every day, then that, you know, they're... Now they've got every day, they've
you're
got
right.
another Rory.
They've got another Rory, you're absolutely right.
And I mean, they can't possibly have that much room.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, unless they just did one person at a time and then eventually stopped to move on to someone else. I don't know. Yeah, it's not 100% clear. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, what's the point of keeping him in the room? Like, why not just send him back 50 years and then let them live out their lives? And like they've done in the past.
Yeah,
in other episodes with the Weeping Angels.
Yeah,
I wasn't really clear on that.
Yeah, I couldn't quite grasp why they had to lock them in the room then, why they couldn't just send them back 2,000 years and be done with it.
Right. Yeah, I don't know. That's a good point. I don't know.
Well, now that I am thoroughly confused.
Yeah, so we'll move on from that. So they decide that, well, first the doctor's really down, says there's nothing you can do, this is the way it's going to be, like you're going to get sent back and then you'll die here. But Rory and Amy, you know, keep talking and saying that maybe they can run away, and then River's in on it too, so finally they decide that maybe they can create a paradox. So like if Rory can get away from this, then this whole hotel room, this whole like everything will just completely collapse because it will never happen. Rory will never get sent back, he'll never get old and die there. So that whole like hotel will just collapse in on itself because it will have never existed. So they decide to do that, and Rory and Amy go to the roof because it's the only path they can get to that's not blocked by angels. The Statue of Liberty shows up again with this big, huge, gaping mouth full of sharp teeth. And Rory decides, well, the best way to create this paradox is if I just kill myself now. They can never take me back, and I just die now, so this never happens. There's a big heartfelt speech with Amy and Rory, and, you know, Rory wants Amy to push him off the roof because he can't do it himself, and she's saying she can't do that. So then finally they decide that they're just going to jump together, that, you know, they're in it together. Either they'll die together or this paradox will send them back to, like, present time, and everything will just be normal. So River and Doctor get on the roof, and there's some exchange. The Doctor doesn't want them to do this, but they do it anyway, and they jump. And I kind of find it interesting. There's sort of a red herring here. This is one emotional scene. I mean, this is where I definitely started crying. Patrick, I just think you have no soul if you didn't cry at this scene. Dave, were you a little teary-eyed for this, or are you a Patrick?
I was more on the order of Patrick. I apologize.
Okay. Well, maybe because you watched it in a big group with a lot of people. I don't know. If you were watching it, like, with Patrick's family, you gotta look tough in front of the family.
Yeah.
It was sad, but I was expecting just this real gut punch, and it didn't seem to have it. But that's just me.
Especially at that moment. That wasn't the gut-wrenching moment.
Yeah, it really wasn't necessarily, like, sad, because they were going through this together, and it was a decision they made, and, you know, that's that. But I definitely was getting teary-eyed. So they jump, and lo and behold, it works. The whole hotel just disappears from time, and they're all sent back to present time. But where they're sent back is not the park where they originally were. It's this cemetery, which is where they were sent back when the Doctor bounced off of the 30s and couldn't get there the first time. They keep arriving in the cemetery. And, you know, Amy continues to ask why, and the Doctor says, like, you know, who knows? You know, this graveyard and then that moment in time are somehow linked. But it doesn't matter. Like, we're okay. So River and the Doctor have some cute banter about repainting the TARDIS and changing the light bulb on top and just, you know, married couple kind of stuff, which is cute. Amy and Rory are coming along, but Rory stops, goes back to a gravestone and sees his name written on it. And then at that moment, an angel comes up behind him and sends him back in time anyway.
Can I mention quickly how yes. Rory's first reaction when he sees his name is, someone has the same name as me?
Yeah, that's so great. Yeah, I mean, how naive do you have to be? Someone has the exact same name as me. Yeah, that was pretty great. And I thought this was weird. I mean, they kind of prepare you for them to die. And then it's like, oh, everything's okay. And then 5 minutes later, it's like, oh, everything's not okay. Like, they are going to die. it was just kind of weird, like this sort of roller coaster of emotion. But so yeah, so then the angel's still there, and Amy, you know, is freaking out. The doctor comes out of the TARDIS, and then this segment will open with is this conversation. But Amy deciding that she wants to get set back too, that she can't live without Rory, and it's better that they just die together in that hotel room rather than just die separately and age separately from each other. The doctor tries to get her to come back into the TARDIS and is really pleading with her, and I thought this was a great moment because you really like sense the desperation and like his knowing that this is it. Like he can't ever see her again if this happens. Like because of everything that happened in the 30s and all this like time energy and, you know, whatever other babble they come up with to rationalize things. Like he says he can never go back to that time period. That if he does, like, it could just blow up New York City. It could just kill everyone because of just the paradox and all this kind of stuff. And she decides to go. And so she lets the angel take her, and she goes back, too. So you said, Patrick, you thought this was maybe the more emotional payoff versus the scene on the roof?
This is the more emotional payoff, but for me, it felt really, really rushed. Because, like, everything's going really well. Rory's just gone almost immediately. And he has no, like, proper farewell, I felt. They just kind of made him disappear.
You know, that's true.
And they left Amy there to do all the talking and do the farewells.
That's a good point, because this has been Amy and the Doctor's story. I mean, Rory's played such a big role and become, you know, such a part of the Doctor's life. It is weird that he didn't get his chance to say anything. That's a good point.
Yeah. And then even after he was gone, there was maybe about 2.5-3 minutes of Amy talking to the doctor, and then she's gone as well. Like, I think to do a proper farewell, they could have done one of the situations where they extend the episode maybe an extra 10 minutes and do something really special like they did for David Tennant's last episode, where he had that, like, 20 minutes of just visiting old companions and
But that's never happened for companions as they leave. I mean, think of like when Rose left. I mean, he did get that chance to say goodbye to her.
There was the whole beach scene, and for me, that was a lot. There was a stronger impact with that scene than just standing in a cemetery and just yelling at each other.
Yeah,
disappearing.
I'd have to watch it again. I know that scene really affected me the first time I watched it. Like, I thought that was really well done, but I felt like this scene and this current episode was more emotional to me. Maybe because Amy and Rory had been around a little longer. I mean, only an extra half season, but
I certainly feel if I go back and watch this again, it's definitely going to affect me on a greater scale. For instance, when I watch the Lost ending again, hits me harder every single time.
When Vincent comes up and sits next to...
Yes, that, and the plane and the church and everything.
Kills me, yeah.
But I feel like this ending will have that same type of effect on me, where it'll grow on me over time.
Yeah. What did you think about it, Dave?
I think it seemed like Amy was more worried about, you know, between her and Rory ending... And she didn't want to see that end, but she just kind of like, you know, oh, you're just a doctor, but he's my husband. Yeah. And after all that they built up between Amy and the doctor, you know, he was the raggedy man. You know, he came to her when she was really young, and then there's, you know, he takes her away on her wedding night. You know, she just runs away with him.
Mm-hmm.
And then this finale, it was her just being like, but I can't leave Rory, you know. And it, like, going back to the Rose farewell episode, you know, you could tell that Rose was like, this is the last time I'm ever going to see you. The doctor was like, yeah, this is the last time I'm ever gonna see you, and you could tell that they were upset about it, and that was the end. But Amy just didn't seem like she cared that this was gonna be the last time she ever saw the doctor. You know, and I know that's not true, but it really just wasn't. It didn't hit me as hard, and I think that's why.
Well, I think part of that, and I think they've done a good job sort of building up towards that. I mean, with season 5, it really was like, I mean, at some point she does try to like like basically bang the Doctor. I mean, she's really into the Doctor. But with season six and then this season, I mean, you see her kind of, in a way, almost like fall more in love with Rory. And I think their relationship is strengthened by traveling with the Doctor, particularly at the end of season five when, you know, it turns out he's, like, waited 2,000 years to save Amy, you know, when he's, like, the Centurion and everything. And I think that's finally really proven in the mid-season finale of season six, where Amy's giving this speech about to Melody, to the baby, you know, about how the man, you know, she loves and the baby's father is coming for her. You know, it's this man who's lived, you know, thousands of years and he's, you know, traveled all over space. And then, it turns out it's Rory. And, you know, that's who she's talking about. And I think with that moment, it's not hard to believe now that it's Rory she's more concerned about spending the rest of her life with versus the Doctor. So I understand what you're saying. Like, she didn't seem to have much concern about the fact that she wasn't going to see the Doctor again, but I have no problem believing that she preferred to go with Rory rather than the Doctor.
And, yeah, and it's not that I have a problem with it. It's just, you know, that it seemed to help mitigate the fact that I was never going to see her again on, you know, she was not going to be traveling with the Doctor again, I should put it. Because
that's true. Whereas, like, with Rose, you felt like they could just travel together, like, until Rose died, basically. I mean, yeah. They really were, like, in love with each other in a way, you know? I mean, they wanted to spend as long as they could together, and they couldn't do that. Whereas, you're right, Amy, it seemed, I mean, even the episode before, it seemed like they were going to maybe even just stop traveling with the Doctor altogether. Like, he wasn't as important to them anymore.
And I don't know if you remember the episode, The Girl in the Fireplace. The one with Madame de Pompadour, she met the Doctor and she wanted to see the stars. She didn't even care that he could time travel. She just wanted to go to all these exotic locations. And, like, you know, she was only in that one episode, but that really hit me hard when she died, because it just seemed like, you know, she met this man. She really did fall in love with him. And then she couldn't. And it was similar to Rose, except you had two seasons. And she found out that, you know, this man's amazing. He's taken me to the stars. He's taken me through time. But now I can never see him again. And yeah, with Amy and Rory, you know, I guess it helps to know that Amy does have somebody. She's not just alone.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, no, I mean, it's a good point. You're right. I mean, she didn't seem as worried about leaving the Doctor. She does get one last chance to say goodbye to him. She gets to write the epilogue in the book that River writes. So she writes this epilogue. The Doctor runs in great slow motion fashion, by the way, across this bridge in New York to get back to the park where they were eating at, and goes to the basket with the last page that he ripped out, and it's Amy's epilogue to him. And basically, I mean, and this is what this segment will close with, by the way, so you will hear it very soon. But yeah, I mean, basically just tells him, you know, that she really, like, I cares about him and really appreciates all the things they did together, but that, you know, she's happy with Rory and they're together and, you know, that they're doing fine. And basically, I'm not sure if she reiterates it, but I know River does before that, like, don't travel alone. Like, you know, like, don't be alone, find someone to be with. As you continue to travel, and then also tells the Doctor to go visit her as still a kid, in that time between when the Doctor first showed up and then he shows up, like, whatever, however long we said, like 10 or 15 years later.
I definitely feel like that would create a paradox.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. I was thinking that too. I was like, well, that, like, changes everything.
but in the current, after he rebooted the universe, he technically never visited her when she was younger. So.
Well, yeah, I don't know.
I mean, that episode I had to watch four or five times to figure out.
I guess you're right. Yeah, I mean, they get their memories back, but you're right. Technically, in that universe, he never did go visit her, right? But then she's waiting outside, like, as if he did, so. I don't know, you're right. This is another time travel thing where it just makes your head hurt if you think about it too much.
Just accept. It was sweet.
Exactly. There you go. Yeah, they got one little final goodbye. And I think that was the moment where she kind of reflects on her time with the Doctor and how much she did love it, if she didn't get the chance to in her original speech. So, yeah. I mean, overall, I thought a great episode. There are a few plot holes, like we talked about, like with the hotel and the fact that no one seemed concerned that the Statue of Liberty was walking around New York City. So, do you guys think this was a better use of the Statue of Liberty walking around, or Ghostbusters 2? I don't know your opinion on that.
I liked it here, although I'm a huge Doctor Who fan, so slightly biased.
Yeah. But then again, the Statue of Liberty is controlled with, like, an NES advance pad in Ghostbusters 2, so there's that.
True, but there weren't weeping angels.
That's true.
But that's another thing you have to think about, and I talked to Patrick about this. The Statue of Liberty, it steps off her pedestal. You know, people are going to notice.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, I know it's like nighttime.
No, the second that, yeah, this they even say that in the intro, New York, the city that never sleeps.
Yeah.
You know, as soon as she takes a step off, you're going to have engineers just everywhere for the rest of its existence there, wondering
right.
how this enormous chunk of metal actually moved.
Right. Plus if the idea is that you can't look, like, if anyone looks at the Weeping Angels, they turn to statue. Well, like, I'm sure at any moment in New York City, someone is looking at the Statue of Liberty.
Yeah.
Like, how does it ever have the opportunity to even move? So, yeah. That was obviously just a neat gimmick they wanted to put in. It doesn't make much sense in the context of the rules of the Weeping Angels, that's for sure. Or the rules of society seeing a giant statue move around, so.
Yes.
But I mean, and then you think of, you know, all the other Weeping Angels are stone statues, so maybe the Statue of Liberty does have some special rules. You know, maybe she's an exception.
Yeah, well, right, because it wouldn't be pure stone, yeah.
I'm sure that's something we'll never find out.
No, absolutely not. It'll just never be mentioned again. So, but overall, I thought very enjoyable. I thought a really good conclusion to the mid-season here.
Yeah.
It has me super excited for Christmas when the Doctor returns.
When might I add, you'll be watching Doctor Who possibly on Nintendo TV this Christmas.
That's true. That's true. It could happen.
Yeah.
That's exciting. And as we saw in the little snippet, there wasn't very much to go by, but we do see Oswin return, and obviously it looks set in the past, but there she is, not a Dalek.
I believe they've announced it's Victorian-era London.
Okay.
Yeah.
So there you go. So far removed from when we found her last in the future inside of a Dalek.
I've read online, do you think she's going to come back as a new character entirely, or as Oswin?
How could she? I just don't see how she could come back as a new character.
I just read that somewhere where someone was like, maybe speculated that she was just going to be a brand new character, and like she was just playing someone different. Like, Amy played one of those Cirrus ladies in the Fires of Pompeii.
Yeah, but that was like
that's different.
Like,
I know.
2 years before they decided she was going to be a companion.
Yes.
I mean, this is like they knew it going into the season. So
just a little bit of thought.
Or like she's going to play like her great 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 grandmother or something like that.
Yeah.
No, I think it'll be the same character. I mean, that just seems too silly to not. But I'm interested to see how they resolve those differences. But
yeah,
I think it's going to be the same character.
Yeah,
I read somewhere online, and they were talking about somehow, apparently it was written in that Oswin has a sister, a twin sister, so I don't know that's going to come into play, but the other half of that is, you see her as a Dalek, and that's probably how she's going to end, so the Doctor not being good with endings, as we saw in The Angels Take Manhattan, he already knows how he's going to lose her. Or at least the end of her. So if he goes back in time and picks her up, you know, he's always going to know that.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of the same with River. I mean, he knows how River dies. She dies in that David Tennant episode.
Yeah.
But, you know, he never lets on about it. He never tells her. Because he can't, you know, he can't change time. So, but you're right. Maybe it's something like that. Maybe he picks up Oswin and knows how it's going to end, but just spends as much time with her as he can. I don't know. But then how does she forget who he is? I mean, she doesn't know who he is by that point, you know, when they meet in the Asylum of the Daleks. So, I don't know. It's interesting. There's a lot of different ways they could take it. I really hope it's not something cheesy like a twin sister. I really hope it's not.
I think Stephen Moffat's better than that.
I think so too. And I don't think it's going to be a completely separate character. That just seems crazy. So we'll see. I'm excited. It's not too far away. 2 months. Of course, we don't know when after the Christmas special that it'll come back, you know, but...
It'll probably be April again.
Yeah.
I think that's generally when they do it.
Yeah, which is too far.
But... I'm just sick of this break already. I'm ready for the next episode. I mean...
Yeah.
I never understood that. Why do they have the mid-season breaks? It just...
Oh, they just started it with the sixth season. It's always been straight through.
Yeah.
I thought they did that for the fifth.
No,
I don't think so.
Fifth was straight through, I'm almost positive. Sixth, they did it. It ended with a good man goes to war, and then it came back with, let's kill Hitler.
That's right.
Yeah.
But I the breaks probably make it better for the actors, more flexible in their schedules.
Yeah, that could be. Plus, British TV's weird, man. They just do whatever they want. I mean, look at Sherlock.
I was going to say Sherlock.
A season of Sherlock is three episodes, and each episode is like basically a movie. I mean, it's an hour and a half. I mean, it's just crazy. They just make their own rules. They don't care. A season of a show can be five episodes. That's it. And then you got to wait 3 years before you get the next season. Like, it just doesn't matter. I love it. So, I guess that'll do it. So, Patrick, Dave, thanks for being here.
Yeah.
Thanks for inviting me.
Absolutely. And I guess we'll see everyone for more Doctor Who come Christmas time on our Wii U's, as Patrick alluded.
Yes.
All right, thanks, guys.
Need that Nintendo connection.
Yep. All right, Patrick, why not for one last time, why don't you give us a little sonic screwdriver?
All right.
Carry us out.
Afterward, by Amelia Williams. Hello, old friend. And here we are. You and me. On the last page. By the time you read these words, Rory and I will be long gone. So know that we lived well and were very happy. And above all else, know that we will love you always. Sometimes I do worry about you, though. I think once we're gone, you won't be coming back here for a while. And you might be alone, which you should never be. Don't be alone, Doctor. And do one more thing for me. There's a little girl waiting in a garden. She's going to wait a long while, so she's going to need a lot of hope. Go to her. Tell her a story. Tell her that if she's patient, the days are coming that she'll never forget. Tell her she'll go to sea and fight pirates. She'll fall in love with a man who'll wait 2,000 years to keep her safe. Tell her she'll give hope to the greatest painter who ever lived and save a whale in outer space. Tell her this is the story of Amelia Pond. And this is how it ends.